Hello, and welcome back to Ladies with Gumption. This is episode 81, Cost of Being a Hero. I am May, and I am here with...
Tatiana.
And Jessica.
And once again, we recap DCTV in a flash. You can find all our stuff on Podomatic. Listen to us on Google Play, Spotify, and iTunes, as well as send in your lovely asks to ladieswgumption.tumblr.com or by email at ladieswgumption@gmail.com. We are also on the Twitter, where we live tweet and retweet news and such at DCTV Gumption. And we're still on Facebook, and we have continuously remembered to post, so I'm very proud of us. We also still have a Patreon, so if you like us and you are able to contribute, please do so at patreon.com/DCTVGumption. And over on Redbubble, we have two shirt/other product designs, so you can go check those out. Our shop link is located on our Tumblr page. And headed into news, we only have one thing, so that's Gotham aired its series finale, I think yesterday, where they had a flash forward, and of course Bruce turned into Batman and all that fun stuff.
I gave up on Gotham like right before that pig storyline started. So I feel like I have a sixth sense where I can tell when I'm not going to like something, because the last time I gave up on Gotham was right before Mad Hatter came in with all of that weird stuff. So I never really made it back through the pig episode, so yeah.
I quit around that same time, but I do plan to watch the finale eventually because I just want to see if Bruce and Selina end up together in a weird way.
I think the actress who plays young Selina said that she wasn't going to be in the finale, but I don't know if that's...
Yeah, she was replaced with an older actress.
Okay, gotcha.
Which makes sense for her, but then David Mazouz was still Bruce, so I was like, well, that's weird.
Yeah, that's awkward. Alas, I'm not that invested, but I have never seen an episode. Shame on me. Moving into our feedback, we have a ton because all the shows are back this week. So I'm going to start with Paulina, who sent us a lovely email. And she says, hello all, hope you're doing well and are having a good week. I think we were, and everyone is a little bit less stressed this week. She says she has one thing to say about season 5, episode 19 of The Flash, and that is Wes Allen kissed. So while I'm still squealing over that sweet and very important scene, I also breathe a sigh of relief that we are hopefully sailing to more romantic waters once again. I truly have little to say about the Snow family drama, except that having those scenes juxtaposed with the Wes Allen family intensity was not a great idea, because it showcased the vast differences in acting ability. But that is all the shade that she will throw. Enough of that. On to stronger, better, more beautiful, and crazier waters. The West Island
family. I thought she was done with shade.
She had to get that last part in there. And Eobard Thawne, Ralph, was extremely well utilized this episode, and he's truly grown on me. Him likening Barry and Iris to the Harry and Meghan of the superhero verse was the sweetest thing I'd ever heard. But he's not the only shipper on deck for Barry and Iris, because apparently Eobard is fixated on the West Islands being united front, and that includes pushing Iris to not let Barry drift away from her. But Iris was not having his advice, and she really liked that. She loved that this episode got to explore Iris as a woman with complicated emotions who is determined to keep her family together. And say what you will about season 5, but the fact that it gives her a voice in the narrative and gives credence to her point of view is great. And this episode highlighted this. The opening scene...
Oh, I like that.
Yeah. The opening scene with Barry and Iris ripped my heart out as the argument wore on. I didn't care who was right or who was wrong, because I genuinely just let myself feel the raw emotions that reverberated throughout the scene. And then there's Nora. The one thing that bothered me to no end is Nora yelling at Iris for what Barry did and not appreciating the fact that her mother came back for her. How many times is Iris going to be put through the emotional wringer with Nora because she's still wrapped up in her daddy issues? So we'll find out when Nora comes back to the present.
That's true.
Thank you, Paulina, for your feedback. The rest of this will be on Tumblr, of course. Then Shang sent us an email. He cried 5 times watching Endgame. He just wants us to know. I cried twice. Supergirl feedback. Lena's wobbling voice whenever she talks about Lex and his asshole moves. He's very emotional about that. The way Lena and Kara look at each other. I love gal-pal chemistry. I really like the scene of Lena kneeling down with a pile of journals and looking up to the image which Lex carved. It feels as though she is kneeling in front of Lex's altar, and even after 20 plus years, she's still as vulnerable. Aww. And then James going for therapy, allowing him to cry on screen and be vulnerable. Love that for me. That whole therapy session was great. Mental health is so, so important, and I'm glad that writers are showing it to us on screen. And then he's re-standing Haley because she did the right thing by not calling Supergirl in. The actress has A-class acting. That is very true.
Yes, I love that part.
Yeah. Why did we get a gay...
And I'm glad that I was on, like, Haley's side from the beginning. So, like, I always stand the right people, guys.
Follow Jessica. Jessica knows. He wonders why did we get a gay warden who was a person of color, and then he got killed 20 minutes later.
Same.
Is a problem. And then
that was, like, unnecessary if they were just going to kill him anyway. I totally agree with that, Shane.
Yeah. Very, very true. And then likes that Nia gave great advice to Brainy. They are really cute, and I'm hoping the writers stop the will-they-won't-they thing because their scenes just have natural chemistry. Drama really isn't needed. I agree. And then for Legends, he says, Ava Lance fixing the wardrobe gave me my gay rights. And he guesses he's okay with Nate and Zari. I feel I'm on the same stance with them as I was with Guardian Corps. I don't particularly ship it, but if that's what the writers are going for, then so be it. The fire in the fandom is because they feel like the writers are just setting up a fandom headcanon as LGBTQ character as straight to Zari. Just like what the Supergirl writers did with Lena and Kara. So that could be true, but that's, I don't know. I have like thoughts on that because of Nate being centered as like a leading man, so he always gets the romances too.
Right, exactly. That's my thing too. Like, if Zari's gonna be straight, then fine, I guess Zari's gonna be straight. Although I agree with Charlie that it's unbelievable. But
yeah, it sounds like fake news. Exactly. It's not realistic.
But it's weird that Nate has to be the center always of the romance. Like, Ray has been here since the beginning, and he's just now getting his romance, and it still isn't developing as quickly as Nate and Zari.
Mm-hmm.
There we go.
Exactly. But more on that when we get to the episode itself. Thank you, Shang, for your feedback. Also going to be on Tumblr. Moving on to Marley. Hello, ladies. I hope you're all doing well and having a great week. I will admit that I've been bogged down by what I conceive has been the monotony of the back half of the season of The Flash. But I think 518 rejuvenated the show to a degree, renewing the focus on the West Island family, particularly on Barry and Iris themselves. The seasons have far too many episodes, and at some point, they lack creativity. The lack of creativity sets in. But the last few episodes are proving more promising than most of the season. I agree with this. Finally, like, a little bit of the fire is back, you know? So as luck would have it, 50% of Snowpack was show-stopping, amazing, far better than I could have ever anticipated, while the other 50% was absolute garbage. The good thing about this is that the absolute garbage can be completely isolated from the show-stopping, amazing part, so I can safely say that I definitely enjoyed this episode immensely. The fact of the matter is that the writers clearly know the magic of their leads. They gave them a scene that they've never given them before because they trusted them with difficult, nuanced material, and man, did Candace and Grant deliver. Completely agree with that. Which makes it all the more frustrating that the writers haven't leaned into their greatest strength, their incredibly talented leads, more this season. The opening scene was incredible, and their chemistry was off the charts, and it sets the stakes of the episode so high and got me invested immediately. Overall, the scene was so, so real and raw. Kudos to Jeff Cassidy's direction of the scene. He did so many close-ups to capture Grant and Candace's respective ranges, and it genuinely felt like the audience was intruding on such a private moment. I completely agree with that. Ralph Dibny was the MVP of the episode. It genuinely felt like he and Iris were in a buddy cop film during the future segments. Plus, when he said that Barry and Iris are the Megan and Harry of superhero royalty, truly amazing. Iris and Eobard's face-to-face was really good. And then the final scene between West Allen was gorgeous in the dimly lit loft. As for Nora, she genuinely aggravated me this episode, especially with going off on her mother for her anger over what her father did. Iris continually pays the price for Nora's pent-up anger and sadness about Barry, and it's getting exhausting. And then she won't comment on the garbage of the other 50% of the episode. Thank you, Mara, for your feedback. The rest of this will also be on our Tumblr. Moving on to Shai, who sent us her feedback. The Barry and Iris argument, finally some real emotions. Haven't seen it in a while from these two. They both were right and wrong in this argument. I'm sure some will feel some kind of way with Barry yelling at Iris, but as I stated last week, Iris did not back down. She was allowed her own voice. And couples argue, especially when children are involved, so it didn't bother me to see them express their feelings, even if they were negative feelings. I was not surprised to see Nora getting in over her head again, making bonehead decisions off of her emotions. Sounds like her father. Apple didn't travel far from the tree. I'm surprised future Iris doesn't have more gray hairs. This time Nora is exposed to the negative speed force, and we knew there would be serious consequences to Barry's stupid decision, and we are already seeing what those consequences are. The Snow family plot I really wasn't all that interested in. It just didn't do it for me compared to the high drama going on in the West Allen family crew. I personally didn't see the point of this storyline because it served no purpose other than to tie in the message of family not leaving family for Barry to learn a lesson, I guess. Her father even showing up this episode after him not being mentioned since episode 7 is really random. I felt Sherlock and Ralph were good in this episode, just enough of Sherlock to where he's useful and not annoying, and Ralph is a much better character this season. Agreed? And I enjoyed the Iris and Reverse Flash scene. Iris was badass, and I loved her letting Reverse Flash know what's up. Thank you, Shy, for that lovely feedback. And I keep repeating myself, but this will all be on Tumblr. Tasha sent us in her Arrow feels.
Yay!
I'm so glad they finally gave Dig the time and focus he deserves. With the exception of his short stint as a Dominator pod person, he's one of the better, more consistently well-written characters on the show, and David is an amazing actor. So her likes consisted of casting of General Stewart was perfect. Ernie and David had great chemistry and killed all of their scenes together. I agree with that. Dig's upbringing involving a general stepdad who made him run training exercises is very consistent with his character, and the occasionally rigid parameters he uses to judge the actions of others, including Oliver, Felicity, and Lila. The Quiggle bromance moments were great. So many times family members have lied to our heroes, but it's rarely for the right reasons. So finding out the general accepted Dig's resentment and judgment just so he could have good memories of his biological dad was really heartwarming. Smoke and Hawk, my OTA babies love each other. It was really nice seeing Mia try to relate to Connor and get to know him now that he has been honest with her. Completely agree with that. And then on to her dislikes. It should not have taken this long to delve into Dig's background and with his parents. At the very latest, this storyline should have happened in season 5 after he killed Andy, returned to the military, got a court-martial, and Oliver had to break him out of prison. Also, how dare they do a Dig-focused episode but not have Lila be there? Thank you. Thank you, Tasha. And the way they handled Dante's death felt really lazy. I completely agree with that, and we'll delve more into that in our Arrow section. And then finally, we have Rachel, who has some Flash feedback, but really it's more of a question. She asks, weren't we supposed to find out the reason Nora visited the past in season 4? Like, why did Nora come back in time to visit Barry, Sisko, and Ralph in those moments? I think they kind of explained it as that she was trying to check whether or not the timeline would be affected by her going back in time to certain moments. Or am I getting that completely wrong?
And maybe, like, the first time, but then I think she just wanted to keep seeing him, was pretty much, because I think, like, she said it, like, she was like, oh, Mom, I guess I understand your weird bucket list, because that's why I went to all those times and avoided you, because I wanted to see my family again. And Iris was like, oh, yeah. So.
I feel like there's still more to the story, and we won't know it until Ybarra escapes prison.
Yeah, I agree with that.
That's true. That's true.
Like, she might have one thing, like, oh,
they're
withholding. And Nora might not even know that that's why they chose those scenes. Like, she might have chosen those times for one reason, and he had a completely different reason. So maybe, like, that was her reason, but we won't know, like, the real reason why she was in those points until Ybarra escapes,
yeah,
and stops getting that.
He gives us his long monologue about his long plan, playing the long game. And also, Nora is somehow gonna. Do we all think Nora is somehow gonna be reborn as Dawn with the twin, so JPK can make appearances here and there at the end of the season, right? Like, are we
yes.
all on board with this? Yeah, I think so too.
That's what I think.
Yes.
And I even think I'm still waiting
for Jacob Artist to be Dawn. The other Don.
Jacob Artiste?
Yes, Jacob Artiste.
Okay.
So that's Tati's fan cast.
another Glee reunion.
And then we did have a Tumblr anon with a question as well. First, happy 80th episode. Thank you so much. Yes, we hit 80. We're at 81.
That's crazy.
I know. So do we, the question is, obviously the Nora we know with all these experiences is going to be erased at the end of the season, but do you think it'll be a la Flashpoint where we're like Flashpoint Barry, we see glimpses of her memories changing when she starts to sync up to the new timeline when she returns, or do we have a different theory?
Like when she returns to the future that she'll get like a upgraded?
Right.
Well, I feel like, from the spoilers that we saw of the finale, there's that one with Barry and Iris, and they're like holding hands and looking at something and hugging each other. So obviously they're saying like goodbye to someone, and so I'd assume that person is Nora.
Is Nora? Mm-hmm.
But is Nora like evaporating Thanos style, or is she like running off into the future? I think is the question.
Yes, that is the question. However, if she does go to the future, I'm pretty sure she would remember still, like Barry, because I feel like the person in charge of the changes still remembers the previous timeline.
But I think that she will, like, evaporate, like, because also,
yes.
Todd was saying that something about the timeline of Iris' pregnancy would be addressed in the finale. So I think that the timeline for Nora's birth will have been moved up, which is another reason why she would be twins and not just her. And that maybe they are watching her, like, evaporate or whatever, but with the knowledge that it won't be forever because Iris is pregnant, which
is already pregnant.
They think it's Nora, but it's actually Nora and Dawn.
You are entirely correct.
Dawn, yeah.
Nora and Dawn. You're entirely correct. I'm just saying that if she didn't disappear, which she will, like you said, she is Thanos-style evaporating, only to be recreated as Dawn. But if she didn't, she would still remember everything. It would just be, like, future Iris and future Barry, who now still exists, who would be like, what's up, Nora? We have totally different memories of you. But, yeah.
Yeah, and I also think it's, because the scene struck me as something, like, it wasn't a tragic, oh my god, you're disappearing type of scene. It was kind of, it seemed like a hopeful type thing, even though I couldn't hear anything that was going on. Exactly. All right, so all five shows are back this week. We have Supergirl and Arrow on side A, The Flash, Legends, and Doom Patrol on side B. Once again, likes, dislikes, Lady with Gumption of the Week, and our lovely Jess will take it away with side A, American Traitor / Necessary Risk.
Okay, so this week on Supergirl, Supergirl and Lena head to Stryker's Island to search for clues on how to defeat Lex. At the prison, Supergirl tries to befriend a nosy prisoner named Steve, who may have insight into what Lex is doing, but he and all the prisoners regard her as a traitor to the country and refuse to talk to her. So she's not allowed to sit with any of the prisoners. They have ostracized her to the loser table. Lena realizes...
She's in the prison bathroom.
Yeah. Her little lunch. Lena realizes Lex has left behind clues for her, and deciphering them could be the key to his whereabouts. Although if she realizes that he left behind clues, she should also realize that it's probably a trap. Anyways, meanwhile, Kelly encourages James to talk to someone about his PTSD, and Alex faces off against Ben Lockwood after he storms DEO and acquires some powerful weapons to hunt Supergirl. Antonio Negrete directed the episode with story by Rob Wright and teleplay by Lindsay Sturman and Adrita Mukherjee. That was my best attempt.
That was beautiful.
Okay. What did we like about this episode?
The continuation of James's PTSD storyline, and that the writers cared enough to stretch it out over more than one episode. I think the scenes between him and Kelly were really good and much better than what we got a couple of weeks ago. And I liked how it shifted into also showing that he has powers now. Like, they were more like snapshots of his powers and what they could be. And it was nice that they tied their development into the PTSD struggle, because it makes sense that they would manifest when he was feeling angry or stressed. Alex calling Kelly for help. Let my ship rise. I think this scene really spoke to the trust Alex already has in Kelly, that she valued her advice and counsel regarding how to handle Colonel Haley. I thought that was really great. And then that little smile and look that they gave each other at the end. I think Alex is already smitten with her, and it's really, really sweet. And then speaking of Colonel Haley, I'm glad she knows what Alex was trying to do. Like, she was above being manipulated like that, but that she still thought about what kind of world her daughter would grow up in anyway, and that's what made her change her mind about outing Supergirl to Lockwood. And I like that she lives in, like, the morally gray area, just because her struggles between questioning her government during, like, their lowest point, duty, and doing the right thing at the end of the day feel really realistic. And then getting to the meat of the episode, Kara and Lena really got to shine, and I like that Lena got to explore just how depraved Lex really is and how his mind games really affected her as a child and even now as an adult. And then Kara coming in hot as Supergirl only to realize that there's power and trust in her work as a journalist, and her coming to terms with just how much good she can do as Kara was really well done. Like, she doesn't have to wear her suit to be a hero, and I think that was a really great lesson for her to learn. The prison dude only giving her the time of day as Kara honestly made me laugh, like, her impact.
Is that all your joy?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Okay. Let me find my joy. Okay. I don't understand.
Marie Kondo voice. What sparks joy for you in this episode? Ask all the episodes now. What sparked joy and what did not?
I love that. I think that we need more of that in our lives. But for me, what sparked the most joy was the lesson that even when Supergirl is out of the picture, Kara Danvers is still a hero who helps people. And to that point, Kara and Lena got to be total badasses throughout the episode. I liked the little reverse prison break situation going on. I loved how Lena had to power through, or I didn't love that she had to do it, but I loved how she did power through her brother's different mind games to figure out, you know, where his lab was. And also that Kara faced Supergirl's bad reputation head on. And even though she does give a damn about it, she also got to learn that people really do fanboy over reporter Danvers. Mm-hmm. I really love the actor who played that prison journalist man, Lewinsky or whatever that character's name was. Steve. And I've seen this actor. Yeah, Steve something. Steve Llewellyn, I don't know. Something Steve, there was an L in there. But I love the actor. I've seen him in a lot of stuff, but he was a lot of fun here. And I enjoyed him tearing into Supergirl and making some excellent points, but then also really loving Kara, so that was great. I really, really liked the entire plot with Alex trying to convince Haley to help hold Lockwood off, because we got to see more of the nuance in Haley's personality. We know that she loves protocol and chain of command, but it's also good to see that she does, you know, she knows right from wrong. We know that she's on Supergirl's side, and that even when she knew Alex was playing her by using her daughter, which was great advice, Kelly. Thank you.
That was a little bit... Well, Kelly's advice was great. Alex's approach had a little bit of some bumps, right. But...
Well, if Kelly had been the one doing it, it would have been better. But I put in there being like, hey, you have a daughter. And like, okay. You tried, Alex.
What would your daughter say?
Exactly. Even when Haley knew what was up, she still thought about it and then realized that pressing the button twice is the right move. April Parker Jones did such a great job with that speech afterward about how she wants to shape the world for her daughter. Mm-hmm. You know, like, I really love that. That was really good. That gave me the feels. I also really liked the time they took with James's storyline, with his PTSD and his powers, and the way that they're combining them. I thought was really interesting, because it's like, the powers they're giving him are also can be symptoms of PTSD, right? So it's like believable that he doesn't really know what's going on, and that Kelly would think, oh no, that's just, you know, you're just hallucinating that because of the trauma at the moment. Also, I really love how Kelly is developing as a sister, and that they showed therapy as a viable option. You know, it's not like scary or embarrassing, and it's something that people should be more willing to try. So it's nice to see James get vulnerable. And I also really liked the way that, you know, that reasoning he gave, that he doesn't want to be weak when others need him to be strong. Because that was like, first off, it tugged at my heartstrings, but it also is good commentary on the struggles that soldiers face, but also just, like, you know, men, you know, the idea that you have to be a man, right? Mm-hmm. Which leads to toxic masculinity. So I'm glad that they were having James deal with that. Also glad that he knows that he needs to reach out to Lena, and that he's not going to let, you know, however they left things off, get in the way of that. So I'm looking forward to how they'll work together now that he's going to tell her about what's happening with him. I'll get to some of Brainy's story on the flip side, but I did love when he made, like, the heroic choice in the end, even if it was, like, cost himself, which is, like, the title of our episode. So good job, Brainy. And I like that Nia is the one who helped him realize it was the right choice. And that she later went back on her right choice because she doesn't want him to get hurt. So.
Yeah. My likes are going to be less organized than y'all's likes because I've just had, like, one of those crazy weeks. But, but just taking it in chunks, James' storyline with the PTSD, I agree with you guys. I really liked it, and I liked not only his conversation with Kelly about going to the therapist, but I also like the actual scene with the therapist and when they're talking together and the therapist comes up with, like, calming technique where he's like, tapping his chest, like, interlocking his thumbs and putting it against his chest. And I am assuming that that is a real technique that people have used to approach PTSD, and if it is, and the way that they did it and talk through, like, imagine yourself where you feel safe, and for James as Catco, but then someone, more specifically Eve, violated that safe space, and so using that calming technique to kind of bring him back down, I thought was really kind of an important way to talk about PTSD in a way that doesn't seem very public service announcement. So, like, in the past, like, we've talked about Supergirl wanting their kind of, like, diversity or social justice cookies without much kind of effort or work into it, just kind of, like, putting it out there and, like, a hammer on a nail. But I think the way that it was, the PTSD issue was brought up with James and how it's becoming, been, like, developing over the course of a couple episodes and not just, like, a one-off, just makes it seem really real and really grounded. And I think probably could have helped people watching it going through the same kind of experiences and without triggering them as well. So I thought that the way that it's been played out so far has been really, really nice. Alex and Haley, I like that Amnesia Alex has a totally different approach to her disagreements with Haley than old Alex, because Alex that knows Kara is Supergirl, she's already got this strong bias, and in the beginning of the season used that bias and, like, kind of viewed Haley as just if you weren't on Supergirl's side and you weren't on the right side kind of thing. So it kind of blinded Alex to kind of negotiating with Haley on terms that would get Alex what she wants while not, you know, being against Haley. And so I like that, kind of similar to when she defended Lena to Supergirl an episode or two before, here you get to see Alex kind of when she has, like, on the same level playing field, how she approaches situations differently. And it kind of worked to get Haley on her side rather than Alex just bulldozing her way through it and damning the consequences. She now has an ally in Haley instead of being an adversary. I also like how that whole kind of conversation came about because Alex went to Kelly for advice on it. I do wish they could have had, like, some other kind of, like, small talk or a lead-in combo so they could just continue to develop that relationship, but at least, you know, there was no threat of James dying in the background, so baby steps. Alex did call Kelly, so she initiated a call, so I guess that's something. So that's great. So I do like that we are kind of slowly building a relationship with them. And then with Haley, I like that, like you guys said, that she does live in this kind of, she's been having this kind of issue of, you know, whether the rules and protocols that she's followed all her life that represent, like, safety and security in her country versus so what happens when that is kind of morally in the wrong? Like, the thing that you uphold is also a little bit tarnished, and how do you deal with that? So I thought that Alex throwing her daughter in her face was kind of a chunky way to get through. It wasn't as, like, smooth of a negotiation as it could have been. But I do like that Haley was able to kind of, she knew that she was being played in terms of the Supergirl thing, but she also made it her decision, and she had very legit reasons about why she was choosing to break the chain of command in this instance and for the greater good. And I think, like, one of our anons in the trailer, we were talking about how it looked like Lockwood was going to hurt Brainy, and that we thought that was, like, a real scene. And so I was saying, well, I hope this would be, like, a really, for Haley, a really big turning point in how she used to deal with aliens and her thoughts about aliens and protocols and chain of command versus her knowing Brainy, having worked with him. So if he was exposed as an alien at that point, then she would have to decide if she was more upset by the fact that he was hiding as an alien, or if she would be on his side because she knows who he is as a person. And so while that thankfully was not the case and Brainy was safe this episode, I do like that we still kind of got that turning point or growth shown in a different way between Alex and Haley. And then with Lena and Supergirl on the main plot side, I really liked that, one, they had an episode where they got to work together, even just as Supergirl and Lena. And I thought Lena showed, like, a lot of strength in having to deal with, like, the crap that her brother, like, torturing her through his journals and kind of, like, playing with her. And then for Kara, kind of learning, because in the beginning of the episode, she went from, you know, who's going to stop me? As far as, like, her being Supergirl and trying to, like, force her help on the citizens who clearly don't want it versus, and being, like, confronted with that at the prison by the Steve guy. And then going from that to having to, when she reverts to Kara Danvers and she sees that Steve is much more receptive to reporter Kara than he was to Supergirl, and trying to, and, like, discovering that she can actually do some good as a reporter, and, like, being a hero doesn't always mean Supergirl and strength, but she can also do it through the power of the pen. So I thought that was really cool. Whew, that was a lot. What did not spark joy?
I did think it was a reach for Supergirl to all of a sudden show up as Kara during the lockdown and have everyone believe that she was there all along. I think the power of Kara's words as a journalist, I said that I liked that part, but they have made a difference. But it is annoying that it took her to be hated as Supergirl to really realize that she can also do good and be a hero without having to wear a costume. Like, I think it ties back to season 3, Kara being kind of lost about her identity briefly, but I don't think they did a good job tying it in long term. Like, that was never a storyline that kind of came full circle in any type of way. And I still don't think they're just looking at it episodically. They're not looking at it, like, long term, which is a little bit frustrating. And then Brainy suddenly wanting Nia to see the future felt random. I know he's navigating a lot of new stuff, and even though he's from the future, I assume the future has changed and he just wants to feel at ease knowing he did the right thing. But he was so adamant about Nia not finding out about the future just a few episodes ago, so it was especially weird considering how they left off with their relationship last time. Like, I don't get that vibe that they're trying to, like, I don't know, make things better with them or anything like that.
Yes, I didn't like, I said that my favorite thing was the Kara journalist, you know, over Supergirl thing, and yes it is, but they had that storyline, like, I don't even remember what it was now, 2 seasons ago or a season ago, and then they just, like, forgot that they had that storyline, and so then it went away, and she was just, like, Supergirling all the time now. So then the fact that she relearned that lesson this week made me remember that she forgot it, and then I was annoyed. But
I think she definitely uses, like, Supergirl as, like, a crutch, and so it's, like, yes, the easiest thing to be a hero.
Exactly.
I don't know if that's, I feel like that's what they want to say, but I don't know if they have, like, if they have enough nuance to actually say that.
Right.
Or develop it.
I agree with you. That's very insightful. And then in the Brainy storyline, which also had very, it's cute moments, I just don't know, like, where they're going with the whole look into the future storyline. Because, especially because Brandy gets so mad about Nia looking into the future, like, to her descendant, right? So then I was like, suddenly Brandy was like, look into the future for me! Forget that other time I said don't do that! And, yeah, I just thought it was weird. I can't remember, like, I remember watching and being like, I don't know what's going on with these scenes. But, like, now I can't remember exactly why I thought it was strange. It just took a while for it to get into gear for me. I think maybe it was weird to me in the first place that Brainy was suddenly so stumped by this. I know that they were, like, trying to show that, like, oh, you know, this is, like, the human side of him. Like, you know, he can't just calculate everything, right? But I was still like, eh. I feel like, just do it, Brainy. Be like Nike and just do it. Anyway. Also, I was slightly annoyed that the lab that Lena, like, took all episode to find, blew up, like, 2 minutes later. And then the data that was salvaged by man, Steve, would have been given to Kara, even if Lena hadn't done anything. So I was like, way to waste all of Lena's hard work, show. But yes.
Yeah. I guess I'll start on my dislikes with what Shang mentioned earlier in his feedback about the warden.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. You have this black man who's warden of Stryker's prison, and, like, Lena and Supergirl just kind of drop that his husband, and, you know, all this kind of stuff. So you learn that he's gay because Lena and Kara are, like, blackmailing him to get them to get into the prison, and then, like, he dies, like, 20 minutes later into the episode. So what was the purpose of, like, oh, yeah, we have a gay warden, and then, like, well, yeah, we're going to kill him. You know, so it just kind of felt like a wasted opportunity. Like, you could have really kept that little diversity.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't obviously necessary because you were never going to do anything with it.
Especially and so it just kind
of prison man should have talked about his husband instead.
Exactly, or something like that.
And none of the prisoners just died either, so that makes it even worse.
Yeah, it's a little bit offensive. Like, I was even a little bit offensive that, you know, Lena and Supergirl were throwing his husband in his face, and it was like, well, and he's like, please keep my husband out of it. He's like, well, we'll be sure not to mention him when we send the police down to arrest you or whatever. So I don't know. I didn't appreciate any of that, and I felt like they just could have kept that. What else did I? Oh, the citizen's arrest, like when Kara's going out to, like, force her help upon the world and save that guy from, like, his car is, like, burning. He's upside down. It's, like, about to explode. And this is the time that National City citizens want to come in and try to arrest Kara, and she's like, okay, well, let me just help this guy first. And they're like, oh no, stop or else I will shoot you with my gun, even though I know, seeing through many, many news reports and videos, that you were impervious to bullets. Shoot at this car that's on fire. Because obviously that will get you to stop. So, like, and the way that they, like, the reason for the whole citizen's arrest just was, it seems like a stupid way. Like, I know, like, the plot was, oh, we don't like Supergirl, but the way that they could have approached that plot, especially with a fellow human about to be blown up in his car, could be that, you know, instead of trying to arrest Supergirl, like, right at that moment, just be like, get away from him, he doesn't need your help, humans helping humans or whatever. Like, if they had approached it at the way that he was trying to get Supergirl to back away from the citizen to not hurt this other citizen, if they approached it as thinking that she was trying to finish off the job as opposed to them not caring that she was helping this guy not die, I think it would have played better. But it just seemed very, I don't know, like, stupid, arrogant of this National City citizen to try to keep Kara from helping someone else not die, and then adding to it by, like, shooting at Kara, and one of those bullets bounced off her and hit the car. So, I mean, it was just, do you care that you're trying to save her, protect humanity, but you're letting a human die trying to get to Kara? So I didn't feel like that was a little bit of a clunky scene. I didn't like that one either. And then finally, with the Brainy and Nia scene, it's more, I have a prediction of how that whole thing will play out, but I did think it was kind of, Brainy's dilemma was kind of weird, because his final result was to delete the drive, but to save a backup. And I'm like, why couldn't he have thought of that in the beginning? Like, why did it have to be like this whole? Because I feel like Brittany would have thought of, well, let me just delete it and make a backup somewhere. So the fact that it was like, he was struggling for an entire episode on what to do about it when there was like an obvious answer of what he could do, it was kind of like weird. And the fact that he brought up Nia's last encounter as like devastating but romantic or something like that, it was just kind of a weird way to reintroduce the two to each other after the previous time that they interacted. So it's kind of, yeah, it's another kind of like clunky scene. But as far as predictions, I'll go ahead and lead into that since that's where my talking is going anyway. But I think that...
And you're probably the only one who has one.
Yes.
Well, probably. but I think that Nia wasn't right, or was she was right the first time when she faked dreamed and told Brainy not to delete the database. Because I think that her dream that she had that freaked her out and made her say, Brainy, delete the database, or don't delete the database, or whatever, was because that dream is what happened as a result of Brainy doing what he did. So, rather than it confirming that it was the right decision for him to delete the database, it's actually a premonition that it was the wrong thing for him to do to delete the database, now that Lockwood is actually going to come after Brainy. So I do think that was the point of the whole dream sequence or whatever their story was. And maybe when Lockwood actually does come for Brainy, then the Legion ring will also come back into play. Is what I think.
Oh.
If that made any kind of sense.
It did.
It's a beautiful thought.
Is it? all right. So, moving into Arrow, which I totally watched. Spartans. Ernie Hudson guest stars after the Ninth Circle delivers a major setback on Team Arrow. Diggle reluctantly reaches out to a 4-star general of the Defense Intelligence Agency for help, despite unresolved tension from their past, aka him being Diggle's stepdad, who he totally hates because his real dad died. Meanwhile, Oliver discovers a piece of information that he believes will turn Emiko against the Ninth Circle, and he tried, and that didn't work, so womp womp. Elena returns with an interesting proposal for Felicity, aka to sell their company, and that runs into some trouble, so everyone's having troubles this episode. Also, in the future, Mia and Connor go to get some information, and they also run into trouble from Connor's invisible our stepbrother, adopted brother, JJ, who also wants to kill him. JJ is invisible now. He does not exist in the normal plane. Avi Yabian directed this episode, written by Benjamin Robb and Derek A. Hughes. What sparked joy?
Not knowing Benjamin and Derek wrote this episode.
That sparked joy for you?
No.
Oh, because.
Okay. What did. Yes. I was more joyful not knowing that Derek and Ben wrote the episode, because knowing it does, in fact, remind me that they do not write for The Flash. But I did like Ernie Hudson as General Stewart a lot. I thought he did a great job. And obviously, we knew from his last name that he couldn't possibly end up being a bad guy. Because otherwise, how could John Diggle become a Green Lantern? But I liked how they maintained, like, the aura of mystery about his past for half the episode. But at the same time, his reactions toward John were much warmer than one would expect based on John's reaction. So it was like a nice, complex dynamic that they were creating in the span of one episode. Which was very well done, considering he did not exist before this, and we are in season 7.
And considering they got this like connection in one episode that the Snow family has been trying to get for like a couple episodes.
Yes, there is that. yeah, I thought that the strained relationship between them was really interesting, and I did appreciate the other characters repeatedly calling out how Diggle never told them about his family, because, again, it's been 7 years, so I'm glad they thought it was weird, too. Also, I'm just really grateful that Diggle's mom is alive, because the whole time I was like, I bet the mom's just dead. We just don't talk about the mom. Cool, I see how it is. And he was like, call your mom. And I was like, oh, yay! anyway. I also... Like, the whole story that Diggle, like, imagined, or that he implied, wherein, like, his stepdad was in love with his mom and then killed the dad or let the dad die so that he could be with her, was totally so ever-worthy. I've definitely seen this plot before many times. I liked that, as well as then the reveal that it wasn't like that at all, and that his stepdad was letting John hate him so that his dad's fuck-ups would stay hidden. I thought that was very, very sweet. And it's kind of like in like a little microcosm, even though it's stepdad, but still, it's like a little microcosm of the difference between Nora's perspective and Iris' perspective, right? Like, Nora slash John comes through this story like, my mom or my stepdad is so awful, they did this, this, and this, and then you see what actually happened, and you're like, oh, okay, I see what's happening. But anyway, I also appreciated Felicity wanting to make sure her program was used for good, and I felt bad for her when she realized that, like, the one thing she's done outside of Team Arrow was being turned against her. So I thought that was good setup for her doing other stuff after this season, basically. You know, finding her life outside of Team Arrow, since she's not going to be on it anymore. I also liked how Elena was, like, super supportive, but at the same time, super suspicious. It's like, I can totally imagine her betraying Felicity with the Archer program, but, like, out of,
like starting sense. Galaxy 1, or, like,
exactly.
Selling it to Galaxy 1.
Yeah, but, like, out of a sense of twisted loyalty to Felicity, you know? So I like that. I think it's, like, a little bit, whatever. It's, like, a nice nuance, again. And finally, I totally agree with the words Jessica will say about Mia and Connor's chemistry. I spent all their scenes being like, kiss! Kiss! So, yeah, I like their dynamic. I would not watch a spinoff show with them as the stars, but I would be rooting for them if that spinoff show existed.
Okay.
All right.
That's fair.
Go forth, May.
Finally getting interaction, like you said, with me and Connor. The chemistry was really good. And I think of all the future relationships, theirs was the least fleshed out before, even though they've known each other for a while now. And I like that we finally got some backstory about Connor and what happened to the missing child, aka JJ. The idea that they grew up with super strict parents in an episode where Diggle was hating on his stepdad for doing the same thing made me really sad. But I'm glad that the episode allowed Connor to explain his actions and that Mia eventually understood where he was coming from, though I had some issues that'll be expanded on in the dislike section. And I also like that this is the most we've seen Mia let down her guard around someone, which is a nice change, because she's usually so like, we have to do this all the time! And
aggressive.
Yeah, that type of attitude. So, you know, she has a soft spot for Connor, and that's really cute. And I like that Felicity realizing that it was going to put people in harm's way erased Archer to prevent any of that from happening in the future, even though it totally does. And I liked like what Tati said about, you know, her trying to do other things outside of Team Arrow. And I think that that's really nice, considering that we know she only has, like, what, 4 episodes to go to kind of wrap up her storyline. And then finally, I really like that Oliver and Renee continued believing in Emiko and that they refused to give up on her. And that we finally got a glimpse into Diggle's relationship with the stepdad he never knew existed. More on that later.
That we never knew existed, right?
Yeah, we didn't.
I thought you said he. Like, I'm pretty sure Diggle knew his stepdad existed.
They existed. We didn't know he existed.
Okay.
This episode. But I did like their scenes together, because I thought the actors did have good chemistry with each other and did well enough with the material that they were given.
Yeah, I thought Ernie Hudson was a great choice to play General Stewart, and I like, he's a great actor, and him and David Ramsey's like chemistry was really, really good. So to have him on there, and he kind of has this sense of like authority and but you could also tell, like, he is, like, the general. But you also could tell that he was very soft around was his son that hated him. And so, like, you could, you're kind of, like, on, like, Oliver's side, like, everything that we see of General Stewart is, like, this really good guy that's trying. It's like, what's wrong, John? Like, why haven't you told us? Like, why aren't you speaking up? And I actually like that Oliver kind of, like, reached out, like, I'm on your side, but I need some help to figure out, like, what is the actual issue here. So I like that in this kind of sense, because John is usually always there for Oliver, that even in the midst of all of Oliver's own sibling family drama, he was also there for Diggle. And I thought it was kind of funny when they first met the general, and things are getting heated, and Oliver's like, let's go, and then, like, the general's like, well, I always make time for family. And the way Oliver said, excuse me? Like, I almost thought, like, he thought the general was saying that Oliver was his family. He's like, what? which I guess, you know, could be kind of, since him and John are, like, brothers. So he's like, you had a dad? We had a dad? You never told me? So that was, like, I like that part of their relationship, and how the issue between John and General Stewart kind of developed over the course of the episode and ended in a place that felt really positive for both of them, and like the promise of a good relationship moving forward. With the future, the Smoke and Hawk scenes, I have been waiting for them to have a little episode together for a while now, just to see their dynamic. And Connor and Mia have a lot of chemistry together. And I like that they were able to finally get this team up for the mission. And Mia is usually kind of like the stride forward, punch first, ask questions later, aggressive type of personality. But Connor is like the more of a diplomatic kind of person. So like when Mia's aggressive, let me in or else, doesn't work, Connor's able to kind of smooth talk their way in through his connection to JJ and like the Deathstroke territory. So I thought it was like a good kind of balance between them, and it obviously like really impressed Mia as well. And I like that their team up led to Mia apologizing for blowing up on Connor after realizing everything he's had to go through, all the secrets he's had to keep, and the kind of toll that it put on him. So she was finally seeing something or the situation from his perspective. So I really appreciated that. Then Renee's willingness to believe in Emiko, the good in Emiko, has, like, it's clears my skin, waters my crops, it's the best. And so I was really kind of disappointed at the end when it finally, like, his light for her seemed to dim a little bit. But, like, his belief in Emiko is seconded by Oliver's belief, and Emiko is a close second. Like, how far Oliver was willing to go, even in the face of all of this information telling him that it was a bad idea, that he was willing to do whatever it took to convince Emiko that the Ninth Circle couldn't be trusted. The fight choreography of their scene was really especially on point. I really liked that. It was a very dynamic fight sequence. So I think it's one of the best ones that I've seen on the show in a while, I think. I really enjoyed that. And then finally, Felicity and Elena. While I don't really like Elena, I did like her kind of encouraging Felicity when Felicity felt kind of bad that the one thing that she was trying to help save the world was actually being used against her and could be used to do like a lot of damage. But I like that Elena was there to kind of give her the pep talk that she needed, and to kind of encourage Felicity and tell her that she could still do great things. So, yeah. What did we not like about this episode?
I had feelings about Dante. Like, not that I'm... I'm not, like,
sad. You had feelings for Dante?
I did, right? Yeah. No, I'm not sad that he died. I just am sad that he was just so lame. Like, I was expecting a step up from Diaz. And, like, I guess he was not Diaz. So that is a step up in and of itself. But I felt like he wasn't that great of a villain, and he didn't really develop into anything very interesting. Like, this is, like, a global threat, but I'm not really feeling very threatened at the moment. He, like, can't even control Emiko. I don't know. Like, and her killing at the end seemed kind of random and tacked on. Like, I felt... Like, I know that it had to happen so we could see that they're, like, wrong, but they're also right, you know? Like, oh, she did believe you, Oliver, but it's not going the way that you wanted it to, right? But it felt like it was too much in this episode already. And also, I don't know, since I really liked the episode where we got Emiko's perspective with Robert, but from that to, like, this global threat, this terrorist organization with the Ninth Circle that she's a part of and that she's now going to take over from Dante, I'm like, how much is she going to be redeemed? I don't know. Like, you know, I'm not on the Oliver and Renee side of things now. I'm like, how far will she go before they can pull her back? And can they even at this point? I don't know. I was hoping.
And why? Like, why? Yeah. What is the why of it?
Exactly. Like, it's one thing to go against the Queen family or to go against Robert, but, like, why did that make you want to, like, destroy everybody? I don't know, brainwashing, but then clearly not, because you were in command of yourself enough to kill the dude that was brainwashing you, and off of words from Oliver. Like, he didn't even give that much evidence. He was just like, you know it was Dante, in your heart. Yes, I do. Murder him, take over.
You just gotta believe.
Exactly. So I was like, okay. I don't know, I thought it was weird. And as much as I like Felicity's, you know, feelings on the Archer situation, and that I found her very sympathetic, I do agree with everything you ladies are going to say about how fake it was for her not to be able to hack into her own program, or even that she wouldn't be willing to destroy what there is of the program and then start over from the ground up. Like, if she had done that, then it probably wouldn't end up the way it's going to end up. And I feel like the reason she chose not to do it is just because the plot doesn't want her to do it. So I was like, whatever. And then finally, future William just, like, doesn't matter now that we know who Mia is. So I'm like, oh, okay. Just like present William doesn't matter now that Felicity is pregnant. Okay, that's all.
At least Nora won't have that problem until she has a twin. Anyway. were those all your dislikes, Manir?
Yes, they were.
I also think Dante's death should have been saved for another episode because it didn't make sense in this one. I don't think there was a proper build-up, and everything leading up to it was kind of anticlimactic. Like, the actor who plays him was excellent, and I'm mad he died before we could find out exactly why he stepped down so that Emiko could take over the Ninth Circle, because that still doesn't make any sense to me. Like, he's a super powerful guy, and suddenly he's like, I want you to lead. I'm like, but why? Like, why her? And then the episode also didn't allow any time for Emiko to fully process what he did before she shot him with arrows. Like, it goes from Oliver telling her, and that's what convinces her to shoot him, versus he's been telling her this entire time that she can be good, and that hasn't convinced her. So, like, this was a quick turnaround, considering everything that happened before. And then while I'm glad we got to finally learn about the relationship Diggle had with his stepfather, I think it's disrespectful and a disservice to his character that we're getting this information in season 7 of the show. Diggle has been a core character from the very beginning, but in general, I don't think the writing has ever really and truly cared about him or his development as much as some other characters. Like, revealing a whole new aspect of his family life at the end of 7 seasons isn't really a good look for the writers, because he could have shared this backstory seasons ago, but now it just feels tacked on. And speaking of Diggle's family, the same disrespect is extended to JJ in this episode, because it's revealed that he's pretty much Deathstroke, and then he had issues with his parents growing up, but we don't hear it from JJ, we hear it from Connor. And it just makes me wonder what the writers were thinking, considering they want to keep, like, quote-unquote OTA around in the future by way of their offspring, only for them to repeat the same mistakes they had with fleshing out Diggle's personal life. And I also agree with Tasha. In an episode about Diggle and Diggle's family, where was Lila? Like, they conveniently left her out, and just like they did JJ, and I think that's very frustrating. And then Archer almost being sold, then stolen, and returned only to be destroyed was kind of a meh storyline for me. I appreciated what they were trying to go for, but it fell flat, especially because it seemed far too convenient a way to set up future events. Like, Felicity can hack into and disable a rocket and prevent, you know, it from crashing into a town, but she can't stop others from hacking into her own stuff. That doesn't make any sense. And it's just lazy writing when she wasn't able to hack into her own program just in time for the bad guys to try and use it for their own benefit. And then finally, I think this episode was just, from a more objective standpoint, was kind of dull. Like, nothing, there was nothing in it that kind of sparked joy. It kind of just existed for the sake of existing. There were some plot movements, but there were no, for me anyway, like tangible stakes for it to be suspenseful as I know that they wanted it to be.
I guess starting with like the Ninth Circle, it just really felt weird that they chose to leave General Stewart and to go alone with a variety of gadgets and objects and like left clues and how to get free. I thought that was like odd for them. Like, what is this, like a torture chamber or an escape room? Like, they're in like a room with all these like helpful hints and clues. Figure out how to get out or die. Yeah, so I thought that was a little ridiculous. And then I mean, JJ being non-existent in the future is just, you know, par for the course in how they treat him in the present. I don't really blame JJ for hating his parents, because I feel like they probably spent the majority of his childhood upset he wasn't Baby Sarah, so clearly he has some issues. And, like, you know, it just seems weird that this whole kind of future plotline we've been talking about, where's JJ, and then we don't get to see JJ, and I thought that was kind of lame. Like, we're going to show, say that JJ is Deathstroke, at least let JJ have the balls to show up as Deathstroke. Like, and the fact that he tried to kill Connor, like, that's lame, dude. Like, don't kill your brother. Or, like, why? There's not even any kind of a sense of why he would want to kill his brother. And I feel like it's not one, it's just, like, used for Connor's emotional pain rather than me thinking it's going to be, like, a story that's going to be fleshed out anytime soon. So it's kind of, like, a waste. Felicity being locked out of the program she created was also just, like, really lazy writing. And I felt like when Archer got stolen and the way, like, Archer did his job and told Felicity and Elena that there's intruder alert, and she was holding it in her hand. And then when the Ninth Circle come in and she and Elena are hiding, the tablet is right there on the table. Like, if an intruder is coming and you have the one thing, the most important thing in your life that has the cost of the most money, and you leave it on the table to go hide, like, why would you do that? Like, that, it just seemed kind of, like, convenience for plot's sake that she just left the one thing that the Ninth Circle needed out in the middle of the open on the table. And then the fact that later they somehow are able to lock her out of her entire program. And I feel like there's a problem that Arrow has created with itself, and not just Arrow, but other shows, too, of creating these, like, magic prodigy characters that can do everything and always succeed, is that it doesn't make sense when they do fail. So, like, Felicity has been so easily successful at hacking for plot convenience and, like May mentioned, like, you know, being able to reroute a nuclear missile in the middle of its route to hit, like, not hit its intended target, and being able to go into all these firewalls and go against all these government servers and just easily be able to make it just look like she's just playing around. And the one thing that she created, it just seems really ridiculous that there's someone in the Ninth Circle that is talented enough to lock Felicity out of her own program. Like, that just does not make sense. The fact that she says, like, oh, I've been locked out, and then she's not able to get back in also just doesn't make sense. So I don't know. I feel like they did, like, a disservice to Felicity just for the plot's sake and convenience of the plot. And then also Elena shows that she's still shady. And I definitely think, like, leaning into predictions, that what Tati said, that she's going to wind up using that and creating Galaxy One. What else do we predict? Or what other predictions? Did Tasha have any predictions on hers?
Does have predictions.
We always say they're going to read Tasha's predictions, then we always forget by the time we get to Arrow. So I want to make sure.
Tasha predicts that we won't see future JJ till season 8 because they haven't cast him yet.
That makes sense.
Yeah, she likes the parallel of Diggle and Andy with Connor and JJ. And I think a big part of Connor's arc will be him trying to redeem JJ so they don't have the same outcome as Diggle and Andy did. And then Elena will be careless with the root code for Archer, or she's purposely going to sell it. Either way, she's going to be the reason Galaxy has in the future.
So we are on the same page as Tasha, which means we are right at least about one thing. Any other predictions? Mm-mm. All right, moving right along. Side A, Lady with Gumption nominations from Supergirl and Arrow.
Who? Supergirl and Arrow. Well,
Haley.
Haley had the gumption to go against her rule-loving convictions. That's always great. Lena had the courage to face down her own insecurities about her brother.
And Kara had courage to realize that the pen is mightier than the cape.
But she did have to contend with a pretty big burden, considering that she does put so much of her identity into Supergirl and Supergirl being a hero. The fact that she had to operate under the assumption that Supergirl is a villain was very difficult for her, and she powered through. So, this is like a record. Three women from the same show. And none for Arrow. I was just going to say the same thing.
I mean, I guess Emiko had the gumption to kill Dante, but I don't think that really counts.
It's not like she found out and then killed him herself. You know, like she found out herself and then killed him or whatever. Whatever. No. Moving into side B, Flash, Legends, and Doom Patrol lean into pain / escape room / two drifters. So first up on The Flash, Snowpack. Icicle returns, which is, you know, what nobody wanted. When Icicle returns to enact the next phase of his devious plan, even though we never knew what the first phase was, Caitlin and her mother, Dr. Carla Tannhauser, must resolve their long combative relationship to defeat the icy monster. After Barry makes a decision about their family without consulting her, Iris decides to take matters into her own hands with her potential second husband and Nora's future stepdad, Ralph, as they travel to the future to get their daughter back. And that is all that happened because Cisco is conveniently off-world and Joe and Cecile had really nothing else to do. I guess spend time with their daughter that they never get to see. Jeff Cassidy directed this episode, written by Jonathan Butler and Gabriel Garza. What sparked joy for us in this episode?
Oh, there was a lot that sparked joy. For a show that generally lacks basic nuance, I think the writers really packed it in in Barry and Iris's fight that opened the episode. I love that it was like a long scene and that there were big screaming moments and then quiet moments in between all that was said. And it was really realistic, the way that, you know, they were arguing with each other. And I love how the director shot it too, like getting the close-ups on both their faces and the inflation and deflation of emotion, the rawness, the hurt, everything. I could really go on and on about this scene because I've watched it so many times. But the level of angst, like, pained me. But the way Candace and Grant went all out and displayed that much of their vulnerability and passion in this scene really made me feel like I was intruding on a private but explosive moment. Like, you were kind of out in public and people were, like, fighting and you just wanted to not be there because it was very uncomfortable to watch in a good way. I wanted to look away but, like, couldn't at the same time. And this scene was also the first time I felt that they were parenting together, if that makes sense, because so much of the season has either been about the tension between Iris and Nora, and then later both Barry and Iris feeling happy Nora was there, and then they got to spend time with her, but they've never gotten the chance as a couple to really discuss Nora the way that they were doing during this fight scene. And I thought it was great to finally and truly get everything out in the open, even if it took them finding out about Nora's betrayal to do it. I was mostly Team Iris, even though Barry made valid points about Thawne. And this isn't the first time he's made decisions without her, and I'm glad Iris fought back with all that she had. Like, they both said hurtful things, knowing how the other would take it, and did it anyway. But Iris was right in that Barry making the decision to take Nora to the future without consulting her centered his feelings alone. And I like that she really got to lay it into him about everything. Like, it was like an emotional dump, and it was glorious. So give them all the awards for the scene. That is all. Ralph was the MVP of the episode. I love that he had Iris's back and didn't try to stop her once he realized how determined she was to try to get Nora back. Like, he was very protective in trying to keep the team together, and I have to marvel at how far he's come as a character since last season. His role in this episode was very organic, and I liked how much he helped Iris and wanted nothing but for her and Barry to kiss and make up. And I think it's really funny that he had time to look up what John Stamos looked like in the future in the middle of everything that was happening. This leads me to Thawne and Iris's confrontation in the future. Like, she was on fire this episode, and I'm so glad she basically told Thawne to stay out of their business, even when he seemed to try and self-insert himself into the West Island family dynamic. Like, he was an extension now that he was Nora's mentor. I was so confused when he started to give Iris relationship advice, and it almost had me convinced that he'd changed his ways, that maybe being on death row made him realize the error of his ways, but there was also like a smugness to the way he looked at Iris before she talked to him, so it also gave me like creepy Thawne vibes. His actions were much better played and more nuanced this time around, so thanks Thawne for getting back on track, because his accent had started to sound like Sherlock before. I also like that this episode made an effort to keep everyone out of Star Labs for the most part. And the scene with Nora tapping into the negative speed force after all the negative emotions she's felt surface was really well done. Like, as was the scene right before with the slow motion of her running away and Iris calling after her. I think that shot was really beautiful. And then finally, I like the final scene of Barry and Iris back at their loft, and their makeup scene was like soft and gentle. Just like their fight scene, this scene wasn't rushed, but the director really let them lean into their actions and words. And I like that Iris acknowledged that Thawne was manipulating Nora, and that Barry apologized for not consulting her when he made this decision. He said he was wrong, which I don't think he's ever actually said out loud before, even though he's apologized in the past. So that was great. Then they teased each other, and like, we got a kiss, and all was well, and it was a nice way to end the episode with the both of them finally and truly being all on the same page.
Oh. Tears. I agree. Before I forget, because if I don't write it down, I will just not say it. I do want to echo that I loved Ralph this episode. He was so great. It was great to see him, like, you know, actively rooting for Barry and Iris, but also being willing to just go along with whatever plot Iris was cooking up, because, you know, he wants to look out for her, and also he just likes having a good time. So he's like, the future, let's do it. Also, I really loved his I really loved him transforming into the guard. And then being like, oh, I have to like think douchey thoughts to stay like this, like this. Like, well, now you know what it was like when we had to watch you last year, Ralph. Now
exactly.
You know.
Exactly. It was not that long ago, Ralph.
That's right. So I'm very proud of his progress since then, and that made him thoroughly enjoyable this week. Also, it was nice that Cecile was part of the like pep talking of Iris and the, like, trying to give her some relationship advice, correlating Barry and Iris to herself and Joe, and also that she used her powers once more to get in tune with Iris and send Ralph after her. So, yay, West Island family, which Ralph apparently thinks he's a part of. He's counting down
the days.
Yes. Everyone's invested in the West Allen family. Ralph was over here like, listen, Barry, you may be Mr. West Allen right now, but 2024, that's my role, and I'm a part of this decision-making process, too. So, anyway, Candace and Grant really killed the opening fight sequence. It's weird that was, like, the most intimate scene that we've had on this show in months, like, between anybody. But it was, like, really amazingly acted and really well directed, as you said, May. And also, they both came across as sympathetic to me in the moment. Even though Iris is 100% right all of the time, and she should always say it, we still understand where Barry is coming from, and I like that. And Candace/Iris were killing it throughout the whole episode. From that overdramatic letter that she was writing Barry, like, I don't know if I can forgive you, Barry. I have to type this up on my computer. To like her trip to the future with Ralph, to her face off with Thawne. I love that she wasn't letting anyone stand in the way of her reaching her daughter, and that but at the same time, she also needed to, you know or realize that she can't push Barry away because she's mad that he pushed her away, right? So it was nice that there was like nuance there as well. It wasn't just like Iris, you know, goes off and makes everything right. It was something that Iris had to learn too. So I liked that. And I like how she and Barry talk things out at the end in that wonderful loft scene. Thank God the loft didn't get burned down. I was a little concerned that they were homeless now, and that's why we just weren't seeing them at home. And also that the ban was lifted on the kisses. So now we got a kiss. It was lovely. I'm also really happy that Iris perceptive enough to realize that, yes, Eobard is manipulating Nora. Like, that's, you know, duh. But he does care about Nora. Like, he does seem to see her as a daughter figure in a way. So it's going to be really interesting to see which daddy Nora prefers. I like that they've incorporated that. And I already said director Jeff Cassidy is great. He did a really great job. I hope that we get to see him come back to talk to the Flash more often. Because, like, not just did he capture the raw emotion from Grant and Candace, he also gave them the space to be as real as they were. Like, again, like you said, May. And also, I'm crediting him with Tom's improved Eobard performance. Although I'm sure that it's all partially the writing, too. Because, like, this is the first episode where I felt like I remembered Eobard from season one. Or Wells of Ard, if you will. You know, yeah. Yes, that's what this is. That's what I'm looking for. And, of course, it's in the writing, too, because we got those clear yet subtle parallels between Wells and Barry and then Eobard and Nora. Like, he seems so genuine with Nora because he does actually want to, like, shape and mold her. He does want to look out for her. She is, like, a daughter to him the way that Barry was once, like, a son to him. Or even Sisko, when he's like, Sisko, you're like a son to me. Murder. But at the same time, he still is going to be using her to further whatever his plan is. So it's a nice dichotomy, a nice blend there where we get both sides of it, and then we're not really sure what he's doing at any given moment. And great job to Cassidy for making those ice fights look cool. Because thank God it had to look cool because the rest of the snow story really needed it. Also, I will give Carla, or the writing, props for the Carla and Caitlin fight. Like, I felt like the argument they were having outside of Icicle and whatever nonsense was way more interesting than the entirety of the rest, you know, the entirety of their little sci-fi story. Because the idea of, like, them both feeling like the other was rejecting them, like, each of them felt the other pulling away, so they responded by pulling away even further. That's, like, the logical extreme of what could have happened with Barry and Iris, right? So in that sense, I like that there was a paralleling, and also it just feels kind of realistic, like there's plenty of parent-child relationships that are like that. And they made me want to call my mom, so they did a good job.
Aww.
I didn't, but I wanted to.
Well, it makes me want to take out that part from my dislike section.
My power.
Is that all that sparked joy for you? I guess so. So, I'll tell you what sparked joy for me. And obviously, like, the most obvious and praiseworthy scene is the Barry and Iris fight in the pipeline. Like, not since that season one, like, you're supposed to be my best friend, Barry. I am your best friend. Like, not since that fight have we seen something come close to this kind of, like, an angsty blowout between our favorite couple. And I think both Candace and Grant really dug deep for the raw and emotional scene, and it paid off in a big way. And obviously, I was Team Iris mostly for the point that Iris deserved to have a say in Barry's decision to send Nora back to the future because she is her mom. And, like, I get, like, all the valid reasons that Barry feels he can't trust her, and I even feel like I get him feeling like Iris was only disagreeing with him because she wants to be, like, Nora's favorite parent. It was kind of a mean blow, but accurate in a way. But at the end of the day, like, Nora is Barry's child and not some random team member of, like, Star Labs, which I feel is, like, also, like, Iris's main point. Like, that's, like, my daughter that you sent away without telling me anything. And, you know, I've talked about this before, and I've probably talked about it last week, but Barry throwing away his child and, like, throwing away that relationship with his child just didn't really make sense to me, and obviously didn't make sense to Iris either. Like, his wife should have absolutely been involved in that decision, and I'm glad that Iris didn't back down to cater to Barry's feelings and Barry saying, like, you should have been on my side, because, like, the crazy thing is, I feel like Iris is most upset that she didn't get to say goodbye, not that Barry took her to the future. So, like, Barry whines that Iris should have had his back and would have had his back if it were anybody else. But the truth is, had he told her what he was going to do, had they talked about it, decided that, yeah, this might be the right thing to do, I think Iris would have ultimately have backed his decision to send her to the future or to send her back to her own timeline. And it's only because he went off deciding things on her behalf without her input that she doesn't want to forgive it. She doesn't want to roll over again and let him do things out of his emotions again. And so I like that she kind of brought that up. And while I definitely see, like, the validity in Barry's point that, you know, this was something he was worried about in the beginning when she first showed up. And here he was right. She was working with Thawne. But, the way that they had the fight and how the fight was written, how the fight was directed, you could see both sides of everything and the rightness and the wrongness and both of their arguments. So all of that I thought was really great. And it made a split when they kind of broke apart. It made the split between the two for the majority of the episode seem realistic and seem like it made sense. It made sense why they weren't working on this problem together. And I guess, like, Iris won the fight because she also won the best plot partner, and that she had to team up with Ralph to go to the future to bring back her daughter. And I just have to say that I know in season four Ralph apologists have paid my dues, and now I finally get to reap the harvest of having Ralph being the best person on this episode, the MVP of the episode. He is definitely auditioning to be like Iris's second husband and Nora's stepdad, and like being the Barry that Barry should have been. But I really like that, first, his and Iris's dynamic. I feel like Hartley and Candace have really good chemistry. Ralph calling Wes Allen the Meghan and Harry of superhero royalty was spot on, and it was just really adorable. And then plus, out of all of the Star Lab crew, Ralph seems to be like the closest, or at least the most consistent, the show has ever gotten to giving Iris a friendship outside of her relationship with Barry. Because Ralph was the one that guided her office for her start Central City Citizen, and in this episode, he offers himself as support rather than an obstacle for her to go to the future and reach out to Nora. So I really like that he was on her side, and you can tell from his experience in season four and the hard-headed, him being so hard-headed and finally learning that lesson about having a team, having a family to support you, what all of that means. And what Team Flash means to him as a family, you can kind of really see it in this episode and the kind of links that he was willing to go to put his quote-unquote family back together. And that's what drives him in all of his interactions with Team Flash, even with Sherlock. When he's trying to, he should have tried a little less on that one, but at least like his interactions with Sherlock and how Sherlock should stay, because he is part of the family. His earlier episodes when he's helping Caitlin and figure out like her family situation. So all of this kind of sense of family, I think hits Ralph the most. And so it was really nice to see him team up with Iris and go to the future. And like Tati, I thought it was actually kind of funny that Ralph felt uncomfortable trying to hold like the prison guard's form because it required him to think douchey thoughts because it wasn't that long ago that Ralph wasn't like a fellow douche himself. So I thought, again, that's a little way to see like how much she's grown, and that he's not the same Ralph of season four. Iris's confrontation with Thawne, well, not as raw as her confrontation with Barry, had this similar kind of tension and high stakes atmosphere to it. And what was really interesting was how Tom played Eobard this episode, going face to face with Iris. I definitely agree that it felt like season one Welzebard Tom, which is great because I feel like that's been lost for a while. And if we're not getting that back, I'd rather have Tom be at his season one peak form of Eobard. And I feel like we got that this episode. And it definitely kind of threw me and threw Iris that he was pretending to be like Team Wes Allen and that he cared about Nora and that you have to, you know, put your family back together, work with Barry. It was very odd, and it was odd enough to make me doubt what his true intentions were, because I think for a lot of the audience, you know, we're like, oh yeah, he's totally playing her, and da 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 da. We know that he's planning something, but in this episode, there is enough there that you kind of doubt yourself, while also still being suspicious. When I think that's really great from like a narrative perspective, keeping the audience like on their toes, really wondering what is his like true endgame purpose. And then finally, I would say, like, the Wes Allen scene, of course, and when they're alone in their loft, was really beautiful. I was kind of worried, like, when Iris came back in to kind of help navigate Barry through the comms, that they were just were not going to bring it up again about, we have this big fight, but I guess we're not going to say anything about it. So I did like that they kind of, that they acknowledged the tension between the two of them, and that they had some things to air out, and that they went to the loft to do that. I love that they both apologized to each other and found some middle ground. And I felt like that conversation, I know people feel like a lot of times in The Flash, their arguments or situations get kind of glossed over within the course of one episode, and it's like talked about, but then it's erased by the end. But I actually think this one felt earned, just through the trials that they both had to go through in their separate storylines. It felt like it wasn't rushed. It felt kind of earned at that point. And then we finally got the kiss after 84 years. And it was a very sweet kiss. So I am glad for them, and I'm glad for all of the thirsty West Allen fans who have been waiting for this since episode 5. What did not spark joy?
What did not spark joy? Well, to say that I absolutely hated the entirety of the Snow Family reunion plot would be an understatement. Part of the reason is because they decided to parallel Caitlin's family drama to Barry and Iris's family drama, and I don't think it connected. They're not on the same level, and to be honest, as much as Nora has her parental issues, unlike Tati, I thought Caitlin this week sounded like weirdly worse, and I think it's because of the writing specifically. Like, the whole "why did you leave me" bit with her mom felt a little bit comical to me when Carla ended up explaining that she didn't leave her. It was like the opposite, because Caitlin went off to college. So that little bit was bizarre. And then after Thomas died, they didn't seem very bothered by it. So I don't know that this was good character development so much as a vehicle to drive Barry's side of the narrative. Like, I initially thought it was the A plot, because that's how the summary made it sound. But then it clearly felt more like the B plot, as it kind of hit us over the head with the family is important stuff, but it was there for Barry to realize that, not so much Caitlin. And then writing in the Snow family in an episode that centered West Allen and their issues just made the other subplot look worse than it was, because we had a great and heated fight between Barry and Iris at the beginning, followed by a painfully lesser one immediately afterwards, and it didn't do the Snow crew any favors. And then Thomas's plans to turn Central City into a snow zone, I think that's what it was. I don't remember. Right? Like, does anybody remember? It was really weak and fell flat, and it was really boring. And to start with, we never cared for Thomas as a character. And we don't know what he's been doing all this time since episode 7. Like, he's been gone a really long time. And all that time Caitlin spent trying to find him in 5A now feels pointless, because his death had absolutely no impact. And I also hate that they had to knock Barry out just so Killer Frost could battle Grace, who, when she showed up, really threw me. But the secret weapon, supposedly, ends up being kind of useless when you end up getting knocked out seconds after Barry does anyway. And then Thomas playing hero, and then Carla and Caitlin weeping over his death was very poorly acted and carried absolutely no emotional weight. I mean, I'm glad they reconciled, but it was a badly executed subplot from start to finish. So the fact that Icicle just stopped right before killing his daughter had no impact either, because it just happened and we were expected to go along with it. But it didn't make any sense to not have Caitlin try and reach out to him on a personal level. And then Ralph telling Sherlock he did good when helping Barry and then convincing him to stay was tragic, because there's really no reason for him to stick around anymore, as much as, you know, I know Ralph's heart was in the right place, but I don't want Sherlock around. I think he's overstayed his welcome, especially after the way that he handled the Nora situation and omitted information from Barry and Iris for months. Like, he isn't family, and I wish the writers would stop trying to make him seem more intelligent than Barry when it comes to figuring stuff out. Like, fans can't even use the "he's a scientist" excuse, because he's not. Twice Barry had to be dumbed down or knocked out to elevate other characters, and I'm kind of over it at this point, because it isn't doing Barry any favors with regards to his development as a superhero. I like the introduction to the Negative Speed Force, but then it left me to question whether Zoom ever tapped into it at all, and if Savitar didn't, like, how come Barry never felt his presence in the Speed Force to begin with? Because that's what he told Nora would happen if she entered it. And then it's just that these kinds of inconsistencies that make my eyes roll sometimes. And then finally, Cisco disappearing for another episode makes me really suspicious, and the excuse that he went to ask a breacher for help with Cicada is kind of ridiculous, especially following the fallout with Nora. Him vanishing is nonsensical and highly questionable this late in the season.
I definitely echo your Cisco thoughts. I don't like that they don't even bother to come up with a good reason for why he isn't there, and then that they don't take advantage of the times he is there to actually give him a strong storyline. So, don't like that. I forgot about what you said regarding the, Ralph knowing more than Barry does at this point, but you're right. Like, it is a little bit ludicrous that Barry always needs someone to tell him what to do, even when it's something relatively simple that he, with 5 years of experience as a speedster, should know by now. So it's time to put that to rest and let Barry be the smart man we all know he could be based on the first episode of the season, of the show, I mean. Anyway, on the Nora side of things, I thought that her little, like, why doesn't he love me anymore? Why did he stop loving me? Whatever it is that she said, followed by, like, her then being able to access the negative speed force was a little bit on the nose and a little overdramatic. Like, Iris came without Barry, and that means that Barry is going to reject her forever. Like, Iris was probably going to take you back so that you guys could talk to Dad together, you know? So it probably would have been fine if you just gone back with her. But whatever. It's like a minor quibble, because otherwise I really did like that storyline. Outside of that storyline, my main dislike is the rest of Caitlin's plot. Everything I did not already say about Caitlin's plot. I didn't really understand why Thomas suddenly wanted a nice family out of nowhere, or like what the cryo atomizer even was, or why Grace wanted it. I also, like, Caitlin just is constantly set up, or Killer Frost, really, is constantly set up to lose and look incompetent. Like, she loses a fight against her dad, and the show just won't let her stand on her own 2 feet for more than 2 minutes for some reason. And then what was the weirdest was that she didn't actively pep talk Thomas out. Like, if you see that Icicle's about to kill you, you'd think that your instinct as a member of Team Flash, who's been here for 5 years through countless pep talks and has been pep talked yourself many, many times, would then think, no, Dad, don't do it. I know you're in there somewhere. Right. Blah, blah, blah. Remember this thing? When we love each other like father and daughter should? And then he'd be like, I do remember. And then he would stop. But instead, they were like, fuck it. Let's make Caitlin the least active character ever and just have Thomas beat his own internal battle that we didn't even see, and then come out and be like, oh, I can't kill my own daughter. That's crazy, Icicle. And then, seconds later, she has the, like, ovaries of steel to say, you know what, I'm gonna fight Cicada while you guys escape. And I'm like, you can't even fight your own dad. Who had no training.
Yes.
You couldn't fight an actual cicada bug. You would not be able to hurt that bug, and it wouldn't be because you weren't trying to. Okay, Caitlin? But she did her best, and her best was nowhere near good enough, and it wound up with her father dying to save her, as of course it was going to. And once again, Caitlin did not do anything. And I was just like, okay. Plus, like, this is like the one part where maybe the director failed because he couldn't coax a believable performance out of anyone. Like, not Danielle, which is understandable because, you know, we've seen her. But at least put some eye drops in there. Like, her dad's dying. Come on. Like, let's make it believable.
They spent so much money on, like, those ice bridges that there was not enough money left in the budget to buy Danielle a bottle of Visine so she could cry.
Clearly. But then he, like, not even Susan, which is weird because that woman can act in other places. And instead, she looked like she was, like, a living frown emoji. And I don't know if she was just, like, trying to match Danielle in the scene. Like, oh, okay, that's how we're playing this scene, you know? Or if it just, like, was, like, funny. Because you're like, oh, this man that I don't know is dying. And my co-star is reacting like that. I guess all I can do is turn my smile upside down. But anyway. Also, like, he died. And then right after that, the next time we see them, they're, like, having their, like, lighthearted makeup scene where the main concern is whether or not she's a metahuman, and it just kind of fell off. Like, I know that the man wasn't in your life for 10 years, but that once again just shows the weakness of the plot. Like, why would you bring back a character that they barely even know at this point? And they'd be like, oh, reunion, and then immediately death. But then it like doesn't affect anything. Like, her father could just still be alive, as far as we know, based on how she acted in that final scene. So, meh. Also, I'm not a fan of the mom actually being a meta. It turning white at the end there, because now that means we're going to have another episode with Caitlin, with a Caitlin plot like this one. So, no, thank you.
Yeah, just
keep going. And I think another thing about that is we've already seen this plot play out, so why are you repeating the same story again, this time with the mom?
Exactly. Like, no one is doubting your commitment to Sparkle Motion. We get it. You love Caitlin, and you really want to make a storyline work for her, but it's not happening. So, much like Fetch, we must let it go. So, predictions, I guess, right? Oh, no, you have to say your dislike.
Yeah,
right?
Don't skip me. Don't skip me. I am the host of this show, David. I guess for me, like, pretty much what you guys have said, if you comparing like the Wes Allen storyline to the Snow storyline, is like saying, listen up, Vibes, a tennis speaking, like that meme. And like, if this were like a game of Family Feud, like the Wes Allen family would be playing like every round, stealing all the boards, and there was nothing the Snow family could do to keep Wes Allen from dominating the game, much like in this episode. It's kind of weird because it was promoted, at least written as a Snow family episode, because it's called Snowpack. The whole episode description is about the Snow family. And I, you know, I understand that they probably couldn't put the fallout in there because of spoilers or whatever, but it just seems like in an episode where Snow family was supposed to be the A plot, they really felt more of a B plot character. And so like in a kind of a situation where West Allens are like the ones that are dominating the episode, the fact that Barry, a 10, through sheer force of plot, is reduced to shepherding a group of fives so he can learn a lesson they should know already, kind of lets you know like how much of an L Barry took in that pipeline that he had to be forced into this plot. And I read like a lot of snippets of reviews about the episode, and it seems to be like everyone is in general just tired of kind of like a Snow Killer Floss family dynamic. As I mentioned when we were talking about Arrow, it doesn't really feel earned. Like, Diggle and General Seward's relationship, they were able to fit an entire nuance and dynamic of that relationship into one episode, so that it felt earned when Diggle and General Seward said goodbye to each other. You could kind of feel where their relationship was. But with the Snow family, and they've had several episodes to do it, but everyone just seems kind of, like, disconnected. There's no character within that family that seems very connected to another one. There's like those relationships, those bonds haven't been really well developed. So to try and the only thing that it was good for was to manufacture a story to support the main story, which was the West Allen family dynamic going on the other side. And I feel like one reviewer made a really good point in that Thomas's return to the show had no build up and was completely kind of nonsensical. If you think about it, we had no inkling of where he ran away to before, what he was doing, or why he chose to come back now, other than, I guess, he decided that one really is the loneliest number, and that he wanted, like, ice friends. But it didn't really make sense, and there wasn't any kind of connection that felt earned between either him and Caitlin, or him and Carla, to make you feel anything other than just, like, mildly annoyed every time the episode switched back over to that storyline. Like, he was already unsuccessful in making Caitlin full-time Killer Frost, so what made Icicle think he could succeed in with Carla? Well, she doesn't even really like his ass as a human to begin with, so it just didn't seem, I don't know, like, I didn't really get what the point was. And then, like, May mentioned he wanted to make a slow globe, or whatever, of Central City, and I'm like, when? Why? I don't understand. Like, what was his purpose? The ice fight, while it did look cool, visually, I think it lasted too long. Like, there's, you know, ice bridges, they look nice, they look cool, but there's only so long that you can CGI ice going around and around in a circle. I don't know. It didn't really last, having kind of, like, lasting effect. It was, like, cool to look at, but there wasn't really a lot of action in there. And then I guess, at least at the climax, Icicle stabs Caitlin, which surprised me, because I didn't think the writers would write anything like Caitlin coming close to death. But I also guess most of Caitlyn's stories usually have her playing some kind of damsel or victim. So being stabbed and in danger of being murdered is definitely on brand for her and how the writers write her. And I feel like what's even worse, though, is that, as Tati said, Caitlyn really doesn't even get to play an active role in her dad's redemption. Instead, it's just like through the power of white woman fragility that Thomas is resurrected and rescues poor Caitlyn from his alter ego. I definitely agree with Tati that there should have been some kind of at least active role from Caitlyn trying to bring her dad out to stop him from killing her, and not just Thomas being compelled by her being stabbed in the chest to finally come through. The introduction of Grace Kada into this episode was really random, and then Thomas' sacrifice for Caitlyn was super predictable, even though he and Carla had left like a minute before. And she's fighting Grace Kada, and all of a sudden, out of nowhere, he pops out. It was just very random. And I felt like the death was underacted by everyone involved, as Tati may have gone into detail about more than I will. enough has been said about that and the lack of emotions. I also agree that Nora getting angry with her mom, who came for her, and Nora was still upset over her dad and threw out those feelings onto her mom, was just kind of bullshit in the sense that, why does, like, Iris doing this sacrificial thing and coming to save you have to be turned around that Barry isn't there, and that means that nothing matters, not even you coming to rescue me. So, I agree it was a little, like, overdramatic, and why so much is placed on Barry doing a bad thing and not this Iris doing a counteractive good thing to show you that your parents still love you. So, whatever. Predictions.
I was correct in that Barry and Iris made up, so I think Barry's going to take another episode, and in the final minutes of the next one, he and Nora will be okay, and then Eobard will break free. So I'm sticking to that one.
Oh! According to Netflix, though, according to Canadian Netflix, next week's episode is something about Rogues, right? I don't remember what it's called.
Going Rogue. Yeah,
Going Rogue. And then 21 is apparently called The Girl with the Red Lightning, right?
Yeah.
If that's true, then I feel like Nora will be evil for a little bit longer. Evil. It sounds like her evil is going to be like Teenage Rebellion. Like, I'm going to party all night and I'm going to, you know, take my girlfriends out to, like, I don't know, smoke weed is what it looks like. They don't look like they're that evil. But presumably, I guess, like, Nora will do something to set whatever Eobard's actual plan is in motion. I don't know what will happen. I think that maybe Eobard's, like, actual concern for Nora as a daddy figure will, like, win out somehow. And he'll end up, like, giving up on his plan.
It sounds more like Nora's becoming the villain of the last, like, three or so episodes.
Yeah, yeah. And then, obviously, you know, she will go back to her parents and somehow end up dissolving into bubbles. Like the Little Mermaid, so they can have their superior child. Children. We will see a bed. Sorry, we'll see Barry and Iris in a bed in episode 21, so that Iris can be pregnant in episode 22. Done.
Okay. Well, they are back to actually physically touching, so that could be a good prediction. I'm going to throw out one that I saw online about the fact that Carla is now apparently in Ice Meta or whatever, and I think it could be a way, because I know that there's been a lot of discussion about maybe Danielle leaving after this season, and if they wanted to keep an Ice Meta on the show and actually have it be a full-out Ice villain, instead of what they got into that kind of murky area with Caitlyn and Killer Frost, that Killer Frost can't actually be Killer Frost because then Caitlyn can't be redeemed, and so they've just been kind of wishy-washy over it. But if you do it so that maybe, like, Caitlyn dies or something happens to her, and then Carla's upset, and then Carla goes full ice villain, then there's a way to keep that around while not keeping Caitlin around after the season if she's not indeed not coming back. So I'm throwing that out there.
I'm down with that as long as she doesn't join Star Labs.
No. You stay a traitor. You stay a villain. Stay over there. I wonder if she'll take on like a, if she'll still be Carla, but also like a nice villain, or if she'll take on one of the other Killer Frost personas, like either Crystal Snow or Louise Lincoln, and how they would tie that into the story. But I guess it also depends on if Killer Frost is being used for Suicide Squad and which version they're going to use. So, well, that all comes later. But moving on to Legends of Tomorrow, Egg MacGuffin. It's not what it seems. While Ray is worried about Nora, he is suddenly faced with his own problem that forces him to do the unthinkable. And I do not remember what that is. Oh, yes, I do. Okay, never mind. Nate and Barry are stuck in an awkward limbo. And so Sarah devises a plan to send them on an easy mission together. This does not sound like the right episode description.
No, that's got to be the next. That's next.
That, okay.
This one. That's the next this episode. One is not, something in the wardrobe.
Okay, so I wrote down the wrong recap apparently. But what happens in this episode is that Sarah discovers that Ava's been kidnapped by the demon Neron, and so she and Team Magic go to rescue Ava. But Ava is stuck in an awkward purgatory, which is also looks surprisingly like an IKEA or a similar department store. And so while Sarah goes in after Ava and they have to work through all of their domestic issues to come out stronger on the other side, on the other half of the episode, Nate is still in mourning over his dad's death and what the hell that magical creature theme park is actually supposed to mean. And then also, Zari composes a text. And that is all
the most important part of the episode.
The most important part. Zari composes a text. What sparked joy about this episode?
I felt some joy in this episode, especially regarding the Ava and Sarah storyline. I loved Sarah diving in to find Ava, or to pull her out. And also, I don't know why Ava's nightmare was like domestic less than bliss with Sarah, but I liked how it served for them to resolve their issues. And I thought that they had some really nice conversations that both actresses played really well, and that it was like the most introspective, like deepest look at their relationship since, well, I mean, I don't know, all season probably, you know, probably since they first got together. So it was nice to see how serious they were and for them to both put all their cards on the table and really talk about where they wanted to go and how far they wanted to take their relationship. Sometimes it's good for people to air out all of their issues thus far and find out that they're actually more on the same page than they thought, you know? Also, I'm glad that they walked back Ava's weird magical creatures can be tortured if I don't really care thing. So I was glad that she was like, I was just being offensive because I felt like you were attacking me. I felt like you weren't on my side, etc. And also, like, I thought they could have gone more into it, but I like that they did incorporate the aspect of Ava being a clone and thus feeling like she's replaceable to Sarah, right? Like, there's nothing that's, like, unique about her that would make Sarah love her, so I like that. Also, Gary just being, like, the extraneous third part. not only because he's, like, you know, weirdly in her nightmare land, and she's like, clearly I have some Gary issues I need to work out, but, like, he wanted to be there. The actual Gary was, like, trying to get in on this dynamic between Sarah and Ava. So I thought that was funny. I also liked the suspense of, like, whether or not Neron would be able to get inside Nora's head. but yeah, I thought the episode played well with the expectations, but also, like, Nora and John pulled off a really good plan using those expectations. And I liked that it was only foiled by Ray's unstoppable love for Nora. Also, I do think that Ray being possessed is interesting and that it's going to lead to a good storyline for him. So it's sad for now, but I thought it was well done. You know, it was like, oh, at first you didn't think that happened, but, oh, I guess they defeated him. And then you're like, oh, wait! So that was good. Also, I was really pleasantly surprised that they saved Dez. I did not expect this. I thought he was just going to be dead forever, right? Especially because at the start of the episode, Constantine was like, well, yeah, once you go into the hell or the whatever, purgatory or whatever, you can't get them out. They're done. They're done for. But then, you know, Ava was pulled out. And Dez, who's been there since before the season started, also got sent home, got to be safe. And I loved, you know, well, I didn't love it, but, like, I liked his final scene with John, that he doesn't want to do with John, which was hurt, but in a good way. You know, he's like, you sent me to hell, so, like, what are you going to do? But at the same time, that he didn't want to forget either, right? He's like, we're both going to have to live with it. And I was like, hopefully in the future, you know, we'll see them in a better place. Finally, Charlie didn't get to do very much, but she was a badass in the fight against Neron near the beginning of the episode, and she was very correct when she expressed her surprise that Zarya was gay. Or that Zarya was straight. Oops. When she expressed her surprise that Zarya was straight, because Zarya is not, but that's all right.
Yeah. Nora working with John to try and trap Neron and then working together in the end to exorcise him was really good. Even though it ended with Ray being possessed, I liked how much he cared for Nora, that he would fly in after her to try and protect her. And I also love when he defended her while she and John were talking earlier in the episode. Like, this boy is so in love and he deserves his happiness after all these years. I also like that we got some progress on the Neron plot and that he had planned to also bring what I assume is his girlfriend, was it Tabitha, Natasha, to Earth?
Tabitha.
Yeah. As a part of his plans. And I liked all of the Avaland stuff and think that Neron kidnapping her and Sarah believing she's just ignoring her calls made sense when we got this episode to explain her sudden disappearance. I like that Ava's Purgatory was an IKEA-like store. It also makes me sad because I love IKEA, but that's a different story. But that it represented like her...
Not for us indecisive people that can't make a decision between the red chair and the blue chair.
It's so hard. So many options. And how like her purgatory kind of represented her domestic life or the domestic life like she wants to have with Sarah. And I also like the fact that this episode not only developed Ava, but it developed Sarah while she was stuck there too and forced her to deal with all of her issues. So it felt very... like true OTP style for them to go through these trials and tribulations together in order to get through the store and out of purgatory so that they can finally be on the same page. So DCTV couples struggling and making it through this week seems to be a theme. And I especially loved all the different versions of Ava, like healthy Ava, ballet Ava, Dr. Ava. All of them made me laugh and it was like really clever on the writer's part to have that. I especially love the valuable lessons they learned and that it made Sarah admit to being scared about anything permanent in her life, but that she loved Ava the way that she was and that she was open to wanting those things with her in the future.
Yeah, I feel like this episode of Ava Land's content actually made that shitty breakup and Ava's two-episode disappearance with no resolution actually worth it. I think that the way that they did it with Sarah having to go into purgatory to save Ava and the kind of, what do you call it? Some literary term that's escaping my mind at the moment, but having like Ava's whole IKEA store purgatory not actually be metaphor. There you go. The whole store representing like a metaphor of Ava's anxieties of not only her relationship with Sarah, but also I think part of her insecurities about being a clone and what that meant was really well done and written. And it goes back to that argument that they have and the fact that it wasn't really about that Ava doesn't care about the magical creatures, but the fact that Sarah wasn't on her side or Sarah didn't take her side. And that just kind of brought out the kind of the insecurities and made her a really easy target for Neron to then kidnap. And I loved how they had to work through it in each of the different tasks. So like building the wardrobe together and like Sarah thinking that she can just one, waltz in the purgatory and waltz back out with Ava with no complications. But two, also through the task, even though it's Ava's purgatory, Sarah's like kind of take charge and bulldozing her way through things without actually taking the time to see Ava's point of view. And so Sarah also kind of has to learn through the different scenarios more about herself as well. And how they feel about each other as a couple. And so, like, right now things are going well, but they have two very different lives that they lead, both in the Bureau and on the time ship. And so a lot of that, I think there were some unresolved issues for Sarah as well. And so them having to go through those relationship anxieties through these, like, domestic parts of the store, I thought was really, really well done. Choosing the mattress and that representing the 5-year warranty or the 50-year warranty, the longevity of their relationship, the monotony of all of the house chores, and having to do that. Would you want to do this with someone for the rest of their life? Going into the warehouse with all of the Ava dolls, and what if you get tired of me and you want Dr. Ava or you want Ballet Ava? And Sarah choosing the Ava as is. All of those, like, they both, not only for Ava, it made Ava's relationship with Sarah stronger, but I also think it did a lot to help Sarah grow as a character and evaluate the kind of person that she wants to be and the relationship that she wants to have with Ava. So I thought it was really, really well done. I agree with you, Maeve, that it's very, like, OTP in a sense that they've gone through, metaphorically, all of the potential things that could have broken them up or would have broken them up in the real world, and they got through them and they were successful. So I think, you know, now going forward into the back half of the season and continuing on in other seasons, if Legends does get picked up, it's just kind of solidifies that anchorship. It was a very anchorship validating episode for them, so I really enjoyed that. And then with Ray and Nora and that storyline, I really liked that it was a continuation of them developing their feelings for each other, and the fact that he stood up to John and defended Nora to John when John was kind of throwing doubt on whether Nora could be trusted around Neron, showed that he really, really cared about her. And then even though it was the wrong thing because Nora and John had a plan together, the fact that he was willing to kind of run into danger to save Nora, who he thought was in trouble, I thought was really good for their love story as kind of a beta ship couple. And I'm not going to talk about the other parts of the episode other than to agree with Tati that Charlie being surprised, sorry, is straight, is how everybody is surprised. Charlie spoke for the fandom definitely with that one line. yes. What did not spark joy?
Well, one of the things that did not
spark joy. I did want to say that, and I thought about this when you were saying your likes, but the fact that Ray, they thought that they had destroyed the demon, but the demon is actually, like, possessing Ray now, I thought was reminding me of the Denzel Washington movie called, I think it's called Fallen, and it's, like, 1998 or whatever, and in this movie, it's, like, Denzel Washington plays this cop that's looking for this, like, copycat murderer, serial killer, but it turns out that the serial killer is actually a demon that possesses different people to touch, and so every time, like, you know, he gets close to finding the demon just, like, switches bodies. And so it kind of reminded me of that. Like, you think, like, the demon is defeated, but actually he's just, like, switched bodies. And you can tell, like, because of the song, the Pop Goes the Weasel song, which I feel like Neron could choose a better whistle choice. But it did give me the same vibes as that movie, which is really good.
I like
it. You should watch it. Yeah. But now, things that did not spark joy. Go ahead, Tati.
Well, speaking of the transformation into, you know, from Ray to Neron, considering how easy the plan was to be foiled by Ray's unstoppable love for Nora, I think it would have been helpful if they had told him beforehand that they were going to do it. I don't know, write it on a notepad or something so that Neron doesn't hear, because, like, I don't know. What did they think Ray was going to do if he saw them going at it? I don't know. But, yeah. Moving on, the rest of the episode is in my dislikes, but not really. Once again, Legends tried to string a big bad plot, like, in the last 5 episodes of the season. Like, y'all don't need it, okay? Your show is just better as your one-off adventures with, like, the barest overarching plotline. So to now suddenly be like, oh, Neron's here, and, you know, now we've moved on from whatever we thought that Hank was going to be doing. Now Neron's possessing Ray, and he's going to bring back his girlfriend, Tabitha, and whatever. Like, no one is afraid of Tabitha. Tabitha is not going to be anything. This is going to be like Malice 2.0, except its name is now Tabitha. So, yeah. Just move on. I don't care. Also, the entire Nate subplot. Was just, like, really awkward and redundant. Like, I liked the dude. Like, the theme park constructor man. He was Nikki, seemed like a nice guy. Yeah, Nikki. Yeah, whatever his name was, he seemed like a nice guy. But, like, that poor man is, like, running ragged with Nate being like, build it, don't build it, build it, don't build it. And also, like, why would Nate want to build it? Like, what did he think was happening? What were they going to do with it? Was he planning on putting actual magical creatures in there? Probably not. Was he planning on making, like, animatronic magical creatures to put in there? Like, that would have been interesting. Let's use this idea, but not psycho, and instead actually make a theme park with a magic theme without any magical creatures. But whatever. Doesn't matter.
With all the money that we're embezzling from the government.
Exactly. Like, we're embezzling money from, like, why? Why would Nate continue to get ever? And then in the end, he did decide not to destroy it, right? So, I don't know. Are we going to keep building it, or is it just like, let this random one thing stand on this empty plot of land and not go further? Doesn't matter, because it was really just all a cover-up so that he could get hit by a wrecking ball, destroy his phone, and not read Zari's damn text, which she spent all episode constructing. Not just alone. She couldn't just think all episode what text to send Nate, but she also needed Mona's brilliant mind and, like, Charlie's snarky comebacks, and I guess Nick was part of it. I don't know. Anyway, whatever.
Yeah,
I don't know. But half the cast was there to write one text to Nate that he didn't even, like, why did you have to send this text to Nate today of all days? Like, no, ask him out now while he's vulnerable. Like, the man is clearly dealing with his father's death. You don't need to be asking that Nate. You could just be like, hey, Nate, if you need anything, you know you can talk to me, right? And then maybe he'd come over to talk to you, and then, you know, you'd, like, make out because you're vulnerable right now or whatever, and then you could just proceed naturally from there. Okay, Zari?
Maybe you should have been in that group. that group chat.
But, yeah, it was just so, like, it made them all look, like, weird and dumb and shallow. Like, why are y'all, first off, why can't you come up with a single text? And second off, like, why are you wasting your time now thinking of a text? And like, making jokes about, like, eggplant emojis. While the poor man is dealing with his dad's death. Please. So, anyway. And then it was all wasted, because at the end she just let it go into the ether and did not tell him. Like, when he was right there in front of your face, you could have been like, I just want to know if you want to get a drink. You know? Oh, hey. But no. No. For no reason. Only so we could be awkward and not get together yet. As if we were all clamoring for them to get together. And this was going to, like, postpone our joy. Is that it? I think that's pretty much it. I mean, I had, like, a couple of quibbles about the Ava and Sarah plot, but it's really nothing in the grand scheme of things. So, that's it.
All right. For me, I think, I mean, for all the time spent on John being racked with guilt over the fact that he had to send Desmond to hell, I admit to being surprised that the reunion wasn't more emotional on his end. I think it went quickly from Desmond not being possessed to Desmond walking away because he's mad at John for sending him to hell, and there wasn't much time for a real and genuine moment between them. I mean, I'm sure it'll probably happen, but in this episode it just felt a little bit odd. And then the theme park stuff is still ridiculous and unnecessary. Nate wanting to tear down the park was a good idea until he decided against it because of sentimental reasons. And for all the legends got on Charlie for using her powers and doing shady things, even though most of that was, like, to stay alive, the writers are really going to give Hank a pass for this abysmal idea. And like I said last week, Nate is the perceived leading man of the series for the writers. So I'm glad that he's getting this time to mourn his dad and everything, but I think because he gets the most emotional development out of everyone except maybe Sarah, I'm kind of tired of him getting several episodes to sort out his daddy issues and mourn and grieve when no other character has ever been given that chance. And I know I sound like a Nate hater, but it just, like, frustrates me. that he gets all of that where no one else does. And then as for the other problem, I wasn't thrilled either that it took an entire episode for Zari to write a damn text, like Tati said. I know relationships are hard, and making that first move is harder, but my God, it did not need three people's help. And then it was like all pointless anyway because Nate's phone was destroyed. I wanted to see Zari and Charlie especially be more involved with the other plots this week, but they got nothing. And then Charlie asking Zari if she was straight, like she was confused. Me too, Charlie. Me too. Finally, Mona being on the Wave Rider still makes no sense to me. It makes sense narratively because, you know, she's not supposed to be at the Bureau. The Bureau's after her. I get that. But she doesn't, I don't know, she doesn't fit in on the Wave Rider. And I think she did fit better at the Bureau. And I wonder what they're going to do with her storyline next now that she's like a creature and everything.
I try, but I just don't like Mona, because I do think that she works better at the Bureau, especially as like a similar type to Gary. Like if it was like Gary and Mona doing like crazy random things, then fine. But like the Wave Rider doesn't need their own Gary. So she, a lot of things that she does or the space that she takes up, I don't know why she takes it. Zari sends a text to Nate. Well, three other characters look on because they are irrelevant to the A plots and the B plots, is basically what happened. And it's kind of just like, it shows just a waste of characters. Like, these, they had to pay the actors a check because it's in their contracts, but they couldn't give them anything to do. And it's just kind of like a waste of, like, why do you have this many characters if you have no plot to give them? Yeah, all over, and like you said, like it doesn't even go anywhere. It doesn't even go anywhere because Nate's phone gets wrecked at the end. So what was the point of going through this whole kind of situation with people giving Zari all this advice to on what to say to Nate, and then she doesn't even say anything to Nate? And it's kind of, I don't know, it's just, it's again like manufacturing this whole thing between Nate and Zari, but to like what purpose and to what end? And I kind of just like, again, a little bit offended that they had to just straight up say, have Zari say, you know, what is this legend eye for the straight guy? And so like basically explicitly having her saying that she's straight, especially on Legends being a show where that fandom loves to, you know, do all of these different pairings against the cast and have it be open. It's the most like LGBT friendly show, and so explicitly saying that this one character is straight is kind of like, well, you know, what about all of the other fan castings? And it's kind of just kind of says, well, none of those matter because we're going to do this with Nate, and it's definitely going to be her and Nate and not any other character that you would like to like magically ship or like non-canon ship in the background. So I don't know, I didn't feel like it was necessary for them to do that, and I am agreeing with Charlie that it seems fake to me. Sorry. So you might want to not limit yourself to Nate, because he is still crying over your Magic Park / Hank World. And that was the other thing, like I know some anons were trying to make it make sense for me, and that Hank was probably, you know, got in over his head. He had good intentions with the theme park, and Neron just tricked him and all this kind of stuff. But even if all of that were true, it's like, what made you think, or what would make the audience think, what would make me think that this was any kind of redeemable character quality for Hank when we've already gone through like a couple episodes in the beginning of the season to kind of show these magical creatures and their thought process? We know how Charlie feels about being persecuted, how the fairy godmother felt about being persecuted. We have all of this history of actually interacting with magical creatures and knowing what their thoughts were. Why would I be okay with Hank wanting them to cage him up and be in a zoo? Like, being in a cage in the dark in the Bureau is not any different, or like being in a cage in the light and in a zoo in a magical theme park, I think is not really that step up. You know, whether magical creatures want it to be loved or not, you don't really want to be loved behind a cage. So, I don't know, it didn't really do anything for me that Hank is really that naive that he could thought he could embezzle money from the government to build a theme park in the middle of nowhere for his son to make him love him. No. Like, my dad, like, and Nate even says, like, my dad made a deal with a demon to open a theme park. I'm like, yeah, Nate, it sounded stupid to me, too. I don't know why we're doing this and going down this park, this, like, lane or whatever, but I still just, the retcon is just ridiculous to me. Anywho, predictions.
I predict that Tabitha will be lame.
That sounds like it'd be a good prediction. Unless she possesses Nora, in which I think it will get, like, evil.
Oh my Dark god, Adam. Get evil, Dark Adam, yes! Okay, that I changed cool. my mind. Tabitha will not be lame when she possesses Nora. But it will be lame that Nora will be possessed by two different demons in her life. Poor woman.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I agree with that assessment. I do not have any predictions.
Alright. Then we're gonna move on to our last show. Doom Patrol. Doom Patrol, this episode is called Francis Patrol, and I couldn't find a recap, so I made my own. And basically, Cliff gets a chance to reconnect with his daughter when her adopted dad and his ex-BFF bump gets eaten by a gator named Francis. Larry, with the help of the Negative Man, finds some closure in his relationship with John before the latter's death. And Jane, determined with a new resolve to find the chief, recruits Vic to hunt down a lead, but Vic can't even trust himself. Someone wrote and directed this episode, I'm sure. But I don't know where the recap is, but tell me what sparked joy for you about this episode.
Cliff finally going to see his daughter, wanting to be her hero and going after the alligator to get her back the gold watch was really sweet. I can't believe I said that about Cliff, but it happened. I wasn't surprised that he didn't end up speaking to her, but I think what he did felt like enough in that moment, so I think it really worked. And then Rita revealing her real name to the guy at the bar and then to Cliff because she was done hiding from herself was a really great moment for her. So hello, Gertrude. It is very nice to meet you. I look forward to getting to know you. I also like that she asked Jane to apologize to her for Karen's actions because she had felt used and disrespected. Like, that's very Rita. And I appreciated the fact that Jane only wants to find Chief now so that he could explain to her why he was going to leave her at the Doom Patrol mansion. And I know why she's still angry about that. I also like that we finally learned why Vic's body is going haywire, and it was a bit disturbing to find out that he was 63% machine without him even realizing it. So my heart really went out for him, and I did like that, even though it took forever, we did finally get more of like a Jane, Vic one-on-one scene, even though it didn't really last as long as I would have liked. And then finally, I really like that this is pretty much the third installment of Jane Patrol, the Jane Patrol episode. Only now we got to see what was happening with Larry while the spirit was outside his body during that episode. And then Larry finally understanding exactly what the spirit wanted and how the spirit was linking both Larry and John together in the dreams were really great moments. I think Larry has earned this closure after all the shit he's not only put the spirit through over the course of 11 episodes, but he's also coming at everything from a better place than he was at in the pilot. Like, he's learning how to let go, and I think getting to see John again was a way to allow him to do that and move forward. And I think his scenes with older John were really, like, poignant. They were very sweet and a nice, like, wrap-up to that story, and I think it was well-deserved for him.
Yeah, I definitely agree with that. I really loved the scenes with Larry visiting older John, and I loved how Negative Man got him to that place. Like, he was, or it, they, I don't know how we refer to, like, it's Negative Man, but is that, like, Larry's name? Or is that the negative creature's name? There's much, I don't know. Anyway, doesn't matter. I love how Negative Man brought Larry to that place, and, like, how it was, like, mixed messages at first, right? It was, I was laughing when I was watching because I was like, I think Larry just wants to get laid. He doesn't want to deal with, like, the talky part of the relationship. But it was also, like, he's hoping to immerse himself in, like, his happiest memories. And then the most important part of that was when he told John that he loved him and not have to remember the moments that it felt like maybe he didn't love John as much as John deserved, right? So getting that closure with John before he passed was really important to him, and so it was a really bittersweet reunion because he got to tell John how he really felt, and also like tell him about Negative Man, which I thought was really interesting. Like, I liked that he felt it was him finally opening up to someone and like really exposing all of himself. But at the same time, I was like, how weird that John is like, yeah, sure, that makes total sense. But it was nice, you know, whatever. Man's about to die, so it's fine. And it was really sweet. I liked also that we saw that John didn't harbor, like, after all these years, John wasn't harboring that much resentment towards Larry, because he very easily could have been like, oh, not you, I don't want to see you, you know? But instead it was like, all this time has passed, so he's looking back on the relationship with fondness, and he's also remembering the best parts of it. So yeah, I really liked that, and I thought it was a really nice cap to what has been Larry's primary storyline up to now. I also thought that it set up a nice potential for his next arc, which would probably be connecting with his kids, right? Since they're obviously still around, and he hasn't talked to them in decades. So yeah, overall, that was really well done. I also really liked the Cliff storyline. I also like him and Rita as a pairing. I think that Rita is great with everyone. She's just like a really fun character to bounce off of, and she's always like, even though she's like neurotic, she's also the one that has like the most level head on her shoulders. She doesn't want to get lost in doing a bunch of wild and crazy shit. So it's fun to see her, you know, having to carry around a literal robot man and introduce him to everyone as an old friend with Bump's Halloween costume or whatever it was. So yeah, it was, I liked seeing everyone's reactions to Cliff. It was surprising. I would have expected people to like be trying to take things off, you know, to actually see the person underneath. So right. It was funny to watch them to be like, yeah, cool, you wear that. We're very understanding and accepting here. And it was also fun to see, you know, Rita get all her method acting on, trying to pass herself off as someone who would believably be at this funeral/wake. Also, I liked how Cliff struggled with, you know, coming clean to Clara, but, like, he wanted to do that to one-up Bump, you know? So it's like, mm-hmm. The idea, which is kind of like, that's why we don't like Cliff, but it was realistic that would be his first instinct, and then to see him actually be the bigger, like, he wanted to be the bigger man, like, literally, he wanted to overshadow Bump. But then in the end, he was metaphorically the bigger man and actually chose to just give her back what she had lost without tainting her vision of her father. So it was like a nice kind of reversal from the Diggle and his stepdad situation, right? Except mm-hmm. In this case, he's the biological father. But he was like, I'm not going to come in and be like, hey, guess what? Your fake dad slept with your mom and she did, you know, whatever. So... And also, I'm a brain and a robot now. So, it's nice that he just let her, you know, keep the life that she knows now and didn't try to intrude on it in the end. I guess I like that Cliff and Jane continue to exist. And that Jane actually, you know, once Cliff explained what was going on with him, she actually did want to try to help, you know. So, that was good, I guess. And that's all.
Well, I like that for an episode that focused a lot on my two least favorite characters, I actually liked both of their plots. I feel like I have said this repeatedly, that episode, Larry's first centric episode, was one of my least favorite episodes. But I think as the series has gone on and he's gone through those challenges with the negative spirit, it all led up to this plot, and I really actually liked this plot a lot, and knowing that while Negative Man was connecting Jane to Cliff, in the real world, Larry was in his, like, dream world with John, and at first it seemed like, I was really confused, because it seemed like John was aware that he was in there, and I'm like, is John the negative spirit talking to him, or... So I guess it was really well executed in the way that they created this dream sequence. And I'm wondering if now, and looking back on all of those other kind of dream sequences when he was in there with the negative spirit, if it was the real John or if it was negative spirit. But it's a little bit blurred now. So maybe, like, because John's been terminal for, we assume, a while. So all of these times where he's had these, like, weird fever dreams, was it actually Larry with John and just not realizing it? Or something else? But in this episode, like, again, there was a little bit more explicit, at least to the audience, that there's something different about this kind of dream world and John in it and him being more active in the dream world. And so I like how it was kind of revealed, first through Larry's idea of happiness with John, and then the next time through John's idea of happiness with Larry in the gay bar where there's no one around that could, you know, judge them or anything like that. And then that's kind of how Larry figured out that he was actually talking to John. And how that all led to the negative spirit led him to Erie, where he could actually get some closure with John before John passed away. And I thought it was really sweet, the scenes with older John and taking him out into the balcony and just getting to talk and have that kind of closure that they didn't really get when Larry first came out of his coma after the accident. So I thought it allowed Larry the closure he needed to forgive himself from the mistakes of his past and letting John go like that in the first place. And I just think it provided like a nice arc, overall arc in the end. And now from now on, Larry will probably be able to feel more comfortable in his Doom Patrol role and his role as a potential hero going forward. So I like that. And then I think similarly with Cliff and his plot, he finally gets to go to Florida to see his daughter. And it's even in like the most serious of plots, there's this sense of this element of ridiculousness, like in the fact that Bump was killed by a gator named Francis in Florida. Seems like, you know, it's a really ridiculous way to die. But even through that element of ridiculous underlying, there's this really very heartwarming story, or Cliff trying to, like, navigate how to reconnect with his daughter, feeling jealous of Bump, realizing how good of a father Bump was to Clara. And I think even in her speech, when he's about to go up and basically insert himself, like, I'm your dad, forget that man. Her speech about how much Bump meant to her when her parents passed away, and even the fact that she kept that watch and how much that watch, Cliff's watch, was a reminder to her and felt special to her that she felt comfortable enough to give it to Bump. Even though she gave it to him, there's this still kind of at the core, the reason the watch was special to her is because it was Cliff. So he still, you know, he thought that he had been erased from Clara's life for all this time and replaced by Bump, but I think in the middle of the swamp, when he's just like frustrated and kind of like breaks down for a minute, he kind of realizes that, you know, he hasn't been like replaced. There's still a special part in Clara's life, or a special memory that she has of him, and him wanting to protect them, wanting to keep it, kind of changes his prerogative or his reasons for wanting to find Francis and fight Francis. And I don't know if Francis knew that, and that's the reason why Francis the Alligator suddenly decided to show up. But I like that was the kind of resolution behind that. And even while Cliff is going through this kind of emotional struggle, Rita being there, I agree, like, she's the best plot partner to be paired with in any given episode, it feels like. I like her approach to the wake as like an acting role, and her trying to like coach Cliff on how to be natural and the whole red leather, yellow leather and all this kind of stuff. And her, you know, coming up with her own cover story. But even the fact that she didn't leave Cliff, like, easily, I think old Rita Farr would have just left Cliff at that bar and been done with it and not want to go follow him through the swamp. So the fact that she's kind of like the most loyal and consistent person amongst the group, and a little bit of like the glue to kind of, even though she's the last person that wanted to be in a team, I feel like she's the kind of the glue or the heart that holds all of the people together when she's around them. And then with Jane and Vic, I think Larry and Cliff had their emotional resolutions in this episode, and Jane had hers in the previous episode in Jane Patrol. And so in this one, she has kind of like a resolved, more resolve, a more determined passion to actually be a part of the Doom Patrol. And I feel like this is the first time that they've called themselves a Doom Patrol, when she's like being really sarcastic about apologizing to the chief because like we're losers and we can't do anything right. Love the Doom Patrol. And it's the first time that that has been really used in, as a name for this group. And I think that, you know, her actually putting together, calling a team meeting, putting together some clues, recruiting Vic to go help her, all of that I thought was really, like, it's the turning point for Jane. So I expect to see that for Larry and for Cliff. And hopefully for Vic eventually, if he finally gets a episode that is actually about him, which kind of leads me into what did not spark joy for us about this episode. And so tell me what those moments were for y'all.
Before I get into what didn't spark joy, I forgot to mention what did spark joy was the running gag of animal, vegetable, mineral man.
Oh, yes. I love him.
He just keeps getting mentioned, and now he's, like, facing trial. It's hilarious. It's, like, it's ongoing. But what didn't spark joy is Vic getting some development as to why Grid's been acting up, only for that to be used so that he could get kidnapped with no assistance from his software. He and Jane finally had that one moment together, and I think they share some similarities in terms of like feeling like they're being controlled by outside sources and unable to escape it. But it was only a fleeting moment before, you know, they had to fight off the crazy bureau. And then I just think Vic deserves more time to really delve into his issues the way the rest of the team has been doing. And the writers refused to give him that chance, and it's just upsetting for me. That's like the main dislike.
Okay. That seemed rather short, but yes. I guess my dislikes are not that long either. It's pretty much the fact that, Larry and Cliff got these like really nice big expansive storylines, but then they tried to make it a 3-storyline episode, which I feel like they haven't done in a while, and the Vic and Jane storyline was like a blip. It was just there so that they could get kidnapped, or just Vic could get kidnapped. I don't really know if Jane got kidnapped too. I'm confused now, but either way, it was just kind of like, okay, here we are. I guess we'll find out next week. I was like, you could have saved that. And also, I feel like it's been too many episodes since Vic got an episode, and by that I mean I don't know that Vic's ever actually gotten an episode.
Mm-hmm. Since episode like 2, like the one where he showed
up. Right, you're right. Episode 2 is the one that is most about him. So I don't feel like that's fair, and I don't like that. There we go. Also, I just like, it's like we haven't found out more about the painting possibility. You know, like how could we get there to this future that Jane saw since the Therapy Patrol episode. It's been like 4 episodes since it was introduced, and I don't feel like, I feel like it's a big elephant in the room, and we're just kind of, it's kind of like,
what episode is this? Is this episode
11.
So how many episodes are even in Doom Patrol season 1?
15.
I think it's 15. Yep, there we go.
Okay, so I'm like, we're running out of time.
Right, exactly. So it's like the Barry disappearing plot, right? Like, how can we not talk about this? This is very important. We want to avoid this from this happening. And instead they're just like, wow, I sure hope that the stuff going on right now isn't going to lead to that. It probably is. Okay, moving on. And now that we've got Jane and, you know, Vic together for a plot, that would be the perfect opportunity to address it, see if they can find out more. But whatever. We'll see if that happens next week, I guess.
Yeah, I feel like I've been waiting for a long time for Jane and Vic to have a story together, because I feel like we've seen almost every other combination of Doom Patrol characters, but not Jane and Vic. And the one time they actually do have a story together, it gets the shortest amount of screen time. So that wasn't cool. I thought it was interesting that the one time that Jane tries to call a meeting and Vic is like not showing up. Like, you call a meeting and get on to the rest of the Doom Patrol all the time about not showing up to your team meetings. And here Jane is at the team meeting, and you're not, you're like, okay, I'm gonna skip this one. I thought that was interesting. And I did like the conversation that they had on like the bus about you know, not being in control, and like Vic, like finally opening up to Jane about what happened with his software, even though he'd initially wanted to keep it a secret from the rest of the team. I just feel like it was kind of short-lived, and it was kind of tacked on the end. And then at the end, it didn't really matter because they both get either kidnapped or, or you know, we don't know what happened to Jane, but Vic's definitely gotten kidnapped. And so and he's getting kidnapped with not having a lot of character development thus far. And I feel like they're saving a lot of it because I feel like because of the painting, they don't want to get to how that will happen too soon, so I feel like we probably won't even really know until episode 13 or 14. And I high key feel like he's going to be kidnapped for an entire episode with none of the other members of the Doom Patrol knowing or caring where he is until it's convenient for the plot. And they're like, oh yeah, let's go save Vic. And then we won't have seen any of what he's actually gone through with the Bureau of Normacy in the meantime. So high key, what I feel is going to happen. And not really here for it. So, yeah, predictions.
I mean, that was a whole prediction.
What you just said, you're not here for. Exactly.
Oh, yeah. Okay, then I guess that's it.
Yeah.
Side B, Lady with Gumption nominations.
Iris.
Okay, yeah.
Yes, definitely Iris. She went all the way to the future in just a little time sphere and a Ralph, the most useless person in the world, to get her daughter back. And she stood up to Vaughn. And she, you know, made up with her husband all in one go because she is a woman of many talents.
And for Legends, probably both
Sarah for like going into purgatory.
Yeah.
And I would, do I want to say Ava? Because she had to, like, fight through a lot of her insecurities and her anxieties.
Yeah, she had to deal with her inner demons. Also having to deal with demons was Nora. So it could be another show with three.
Wow. Breaking records here.
And any for Doom Patrol? Not this week.
Well, I mean, I would say Jane, but she didn't really get enough screen time to actually,
yeah, the ladies were kind of just support.
Yeah. So, on the side A, we had Kara, Lena, and Haley. Mm-hmm. And then on side B, we have Nora, Sarah, and Ava. So, it's Team Supergirl versus
and
Team
Iris.
Legends.
And Iris.
And Iris.
How dare you?
Wow. Team Supergirl versus Team Legends. And then there's Iris. Seven people. Oh, my God. This is a melee. Fight!
Okay, so we can...
Who can we eliminate?
I feel like we can eliminate Nora from Legends.
Okay.
Yes, I agree with that.
And...
I feel like we can eliminate... Like, I feel bad, but I feel like... Maybe Lena as well, just because... I mean, she found the lab, and then it got blown up, like Tati said, so...
Yeah.
And she was just... She was just sitting there, so. Sorry,
Lena. All right. None for you, Lena.
Okay, so that leaves Colonel Haley from Supergirl.
Okay.
Oh, you already eliminated Kara? You were like, bye, Kara.
I mean, yeah, I eliminated Kara before Lena.
I think that's fair. So, valiant effort. We have Haley, Iris, and Ava Lance.
Keep Sarah for Ava Lance.
Yeah.
Keep Sarah for
between
Ava Lance.
Them, I think that Sarah was the more active one, yeah. She was the one that was actually fighting.
It was about to be, it was about, like, it was purgatory, but Sarah was doing a lot of the work. She had a lot to fix on herself, too, so. Okay. So Sarah, Haley, and Iris.
I guess I would probably say Sarah. That would probably be my vote.
Okay.
You're like, no.
I was going to say I'd probably, well, I will eventually eliminate Haley because I think while she had like a lot of gumption this week, her story was more muted compared to the other ladies.
Yeah, for sure.
But I think if I had to choose between Iris and Sarah, then I would go with Iris.
Well, Iris is my fave, so I'm okay with this.
Okay. Yeah. She did go all the way to the future, and she didn't let anyone stop her. She wasn't going, like Cecile said, she was very determined. And she knew, like, something, Barry did something that was not wrong, and she was going to go fix it, and she was going to go get her daughter. And she went and stood up to Thawne.
All right.
I agree with this.
Okay. So there it is. Iris wins again.
How many times has she won this season?
I don't think she's won as many times as we think she has.
Not yet.
I don't think we've given it to her since, like, 5-5, maybe? Or 5.
Okay, oh, that makes sense.
I bet we did. I bet we did for 5-12.
Maybe. We have to check. We don't have... Yeah. We don't keep up anymore.
Yeah.
We should have a master list for all the ladies we have... Who have won Ladies of Gumption.
Yes, if only we had someone who kept track of that. Alas.
Erin, come back. Yes, yeah, so that's... It's going to be Iris, no matter how many times she's won before or not. But it's her this week. So thank you guys for listening again. Next week, we will do all of this all over again. You can always keep in contact with us either via email, ladieswgumption@gmail.com, on Tumblr, ladieswgumption, or on Twitter at DCTVGumption. Gumption, gumption, gumption. We'll see you later. Bye.
Bye.
Gumption Junction. Goodbye.